I was a child once. Alright, into the stories. I was a good kid growing up. I did what my parents said, followed their rules, ate what they put on my plate. Maybe a bit too well. Flashback to the green bean incident. My mom told me that when I was a small toddler, sometimes I'd have horrible tantrums and rip all the sheets off my bed and sweep everything on my shelves onto the floor in an emotional outrage. She'd have to crack my door open afterwards and say, "Are you done?" so she could help me put everything back. If I wasn't, she'd lock me in my room for a bit longer as I continued being an indignant little tornado and try again in 10 minutes. I've grown out of that phase, luckily. I'm so conditioned to want to follow the rules and not do anything bad that people on multiple occasions have told me, "Jaden, you're so good all the time. You've got to be rebellious every once in a while." And I say, no. Is that a start? I was such an obedient kid, I've only been grounded once in my entire life. And that story is pretty pathetic. I was maybe 6 at the time and my parents were going out for a date night or whatever to get out of the house. Understandable. Jax was a pretty exhausting kid to deal with, so they left us with a babysitter. Now, as a kid, having a babysitter is emotionally conflicting. On one hand, you don't want this rando middle school kid to be telling you what to do. Go to bed? Psh, you're not my mom. You're not even old enough to go to the bathroom at school without asking for permission. Don't tell me what to do. But on the other hand, babysitters let you get away with way more than your parents. Oh, yeah, mom always lets us have 3 Oreos. It's okay. It's fine. Don't worry. Normally, we only get to have 2 Oreos. We're so sneaky. It was getting late that night, and before it was my bedtime, I wanted to play outside on our rickety little playset. Now, I'd already gotten ready for bed, I was in my pajamas and brushed my teeth, but I figured it's not past my bedtime yet, so everything's fair game. So the babysitter watched me swing on the swings for like 5 minutes and then go down the slide one time. In the morning, when my parents were back, I woke up and they were like, "You're in trouble." Did I do something? What do you think you did? I don't know. Why do adults say that to children, by the way? What do you think you did? I don't know. Seems like you don't even know what I did and are trying to get me to rat myself out. The babysitter told us that last night you played in the backyard in your pajamas.
What?
We don't want you playing outside in your pajamas. You're grounded tomorrow.
What the?
So I was grounded for a day because I played outside in my pajamas. But I cheated like 5 minutes of TV by sneak watching from around the corner, so who's the rebellious one now? There's this golf course a block or two down from my house that had a little lake, and my dad and I would ride our bikes to it every once in a while to feed the ducks. Also, yes, I know ducks shouldn't eat bread. If you didn't know that, don't feed wild ducks bread. Give them candy bars. We were feeding the ducks, minding our own business, when all of a sudden we hear from across the lake,
"Mabel! Mabel!"
There's a neighborhood of houses next to the golf course so people could look out and see the golfers. And in the distance across the lake, some lady was yelling,
"Mabel! Mabel!"
Wonder where Mabel is.
"Mabel, get over here! What are you doing?"
Oh, she's talking to me.
"Mabel, you're in so much trouble!"
My dad and I didn't know what to do. This lady in the distance thought I was Mabel when I was not Mabel. I am Jaden, but she didn't know that.
"Mabel, what are you doing? Get back here!"
We pedaled away. Now, let's put ourselves in the point of view of this lady across the lake. She walks out into her backyard. What a wonderful evening. I think I'm gonna treat myself to some relaxation time out in my backyard. Working my 9-to-5 job and managing 3 children as a single mom sure is hard work, especially since my doctor says I need to lower my stress because it's starting to take a toll on my depression. Okay, maybe a bit too much creative interpretation. She's in the backyard, she looks out across the lake, and what? Who's that? Is that little old Mabel across the lake? How'd she get there? And wait, is that a strange man with her? What the?
"Mabel, what are you doing? Get over here!"
That girl is in so much trouble when she gets back home. I've told her so many times about the dangers of...
Is she peddling away with him?
I hope Mabel wasn't in too much trouble when she got back home. Sorry, Mabel. This story didn't happen necessarily during my childhood, more teenagehood, but I think it's kind of funny, so I'm telling it. I went ice skating with a couple friends one winter, maybe when I was 15, 16. It was busy, but not too busy. Side note, one time my friend invited me to go ice skating, and we were the only two there. It was dope, but also felt like a weird ice rink twilight zone. Anyway, so we were skating around, you know, like what we went there to do. I'm not anywhere near close to a good ice skater, but I hadn't fallen on my butt or head, so I considered it a successful day. After a while, we decided to do one more loop around the rink, and right before we were done, this little boy skates up to me. I wasn't very old at the time, but he was definitely younger than me, maybe 13 or something, I don't know. I looked down at him confused, and he goes, "I like your hat." Oh, by the way, I was wearing a knitted hat that looked like a raccoon, so it was a good hat. "Will you hold something for me?" Okay. And I'll never forget what he says. This is possibly one of the smoothest things I've ever heard from a little 13-year-old boy. So he goes, "Will you hold something for me?" And I go, like, okay, what is it? And he goes, "My hand." I had no expectations on what he was gonna say, but that one definitely caught me off guard. I was so startled by his, what would you even call that? Pickup line request? That I stumbled back, forgetting I was on ice skates. I didn't fall, but I definitely did one of those weird twisty maneuvers that your body pulls when it's off balance and trying not to fall down. The boy skated off because I think he wasn't expecting to actually physically startle me. Thinking about it, if you were to try and use a pickup line on someone and their immediate response is to be so surprised they almost fall backwards, that, I don't know how to interpret that. Obviously, it's not what you want, but, I mean, that's gotta be some sort of achievement.
Hey guys, I know it's been a while since I've had a story to tell, but I have a story to tell. And it's because my birds accidentally laid eggs together without my consent. Okay, so let's back up. I'm sure the majority of you know this guy right here, Ari. Classic piece in the Jaden Animations lore. If you don't know him, you don't know me. I keep Ari in his own room because he destroys literally anything if he has access to it. In a way, you could call it a containment room. But when I'm not around to give him attention, I wanted to make sure he has a friend around and isn't just sitting there all alone and pitiful-like. So back in October 2019, I got Tofu, which, oh my god, I'm just realizing is much longer ago than I thought. Tofu, I thought you were still just a baby. She definitely isn't as well known as Ari, but we're talking about her now. I was so nervous back when Tofu first arrived because I obviously hadn't gotten any other pets before, and it was really important that she and Ari actually got along. Birds can be pretty particular, and some just flat out hate each other for no apparent reason. Some sort of bird drama or something, I don't know. I was worried my birds were gonna mean girls each other, and then suddenly I'd have two singular birds, which then doubles my original problem. I went through the typical process you're supposed to do to introduce them, keep them in separate areas for a bit, let them kind of see each other, slowly introduce them in small doses, and suddenly they were best friends. I was so happy. Plan B of having to get four birds was now not necessary. So great, everything was going according to plan. I have two birds that can keep each other company when I'm not around. Nothing could possibly go wrong when there's a pair of animals that get along very well. It was a peaceful, happy 3 years of two birds who were besties until this past spring where everything went wrong. How could this happen? I walked into the birds' room to give them their morning food, and on their dresser, I find three tiny little eggs. Oh, uh-oh. And by the way, when I say tiny, I mean you would be shocked to see how small bird eggs can be. These things were the size of a quarter. Some of you may be thinking, "Jaden, why is this a bad thing? Jaden, it's the gift of life. This is a beautiful moment of miracles." Okay, sure, but actually, no. First of all, I don't want more birds. Especially fragile little fresh out the egg ones. Remember when I was worried I'd have to get four birds if Ari and Tofu didn't like each other? Why am I experiencing the same dilemma again? Two birds is already enough. Especially since one of them has devoted his entire life to being a full-time bastard. Anyone who has a gremlin pet understands that that creature is equal to like three pets worth of energy. It's a lot to handle at all times, and if my plate gets any more full, I'll unlock alcoholism. Second of all, this is now my problem that I need to handle ASAP. I can't be like, "Oh, I'm busy right now, I'll deal with it later." No, procrastinating would only lead to possible hatching. Not 100%, but there's a chance, I'll get to that later. Which leads back to my prior statement that I've stated multiple times at this point, of I don't want more birds. Immediately, I was like, how did this happen? I've been preventing them from laying eggs together for so long. What changed? Unlike cats and dogs, birds can't really be neutered, at least not easily. You could give them like monthly hormone shots or there's other stuff, but it's just really complicated. And you're better off simply making sure their environment is set up in a way to discourage nesting and egg laying behavior. There's a few things you could do to prevent it, but to sum things up, basically, don't let the birds nest. If they find a dark little hidey hole, they'll start treating it like a nest and get hormonal, and suddenly you've got eggs. No nesting, for the most part, no problem. I looked around the room and was so confused. All they had in there were their cages, climbing tree, and a drawer I'd bought to hold all their bird stuff. And the eggs were just on the top of the drawer too, not even in a safe, burrowed, nest-like place. One had already rolled off the side and cracked open on the floor like an omelet. Tofu, this is not even close to motherly instincts. After a bit of snooping around, I pulled the drawer back from the wall to realize, oh my god, these birds have been secretly burrowing into the back of this drawer like they were plotting a prison escape. Somehow, Ari and Tofu squeezed their tiny bodies in between the drawer and the wall and started chewing the back of it to get into the drawers from behind. They literally gnawed through it like the nematodes in SpongeBob. You should have seen all the sawdust on the floor. Well, here's a picture, but it doesn't do it justice. It looked like a construction site and smelled like Home Depot. Suddenly, it made sense. They were using the drawer as a secret nest. Whenever I was in the room, they were out and about. Hi, Mom, please give us seeds. Nothing nefarious is going on. I leave, and boom, straight to the forbidden nesting drawer they go. Criminals. As I'm connecting the dots on how we got to this point, I realized I don't even know which one of these knuckleheads even laid the eggs. When I got Tofu, I made sure she was a girl. A little lady. I talked to one of my bird knowledgeable friends when I was considering getting another, and she recommended a female bird because there was a higher chance Ari would get along with her more than a male bird. So Tofu has been DNA checked and female certified. However, way back when I got Ari, I never got him slash her checked. Green cheek conure genders can only be confirmed through DNA tests, and there wasn't really any important reason to know Ari's gender at the time. So I just didn't. Over the years, I've just started calling him my big man because of the way he acted and behaviors he displayed felt very obnoxiously masculine. But it was always more of a gut feeling above anything else. But I am now facing a possible reality that my bird I've had for 7 years that I've been headcanoning is male, could have been female this whole time, and is the potential mother of these confusing eggs. Because yes, birds don't need a male around to lay eggs. Think about it like chickens. They just be laying eggs out the wazoo without a rooster in sight. They don't care. Boom, egg. If it's a girl bird, that thing can lay eggs whether you or a male bird wants it to or not. So in this situation, Ari possibly being a girl is the thing that's blowing my mind the most. But one quick peek at their little bird booty hole swiftly gave me the answer. It was definitely Tofu. If you know, you know. I'm just saying, laying 3 eggs a quarter the size of your whole body biologically does something to you. Anyway, I immediately booked a vet visit for Tofu. Laying eggs drains birds of their calcium and overall health, so I wanted to make sure she was generally okay. The vet took a look at her and was like, she looks fine, she's acting fine, we'll give her some vitamins. But she's still got more eggs in her. What? Tofu, how many of those things you're gonna cook up? Also, we gotta limit this whole ordeal to as minimal as possible, please, because that vet bill was not fun. We can't be making this a routine occurrence. It's no mystery, laying eggs can also be pretty dangerous for birds. There's a chance it could get stuck, and the bird just dies. And to be honest, I really didn't want that to happen. So every egg meant an extra mountain of stress and anxiety for me! Yippee! The vet told me conures typically lay eggs every other day, so once she goes a few days without laying any, then I can come back and get her another checkup to really make sure she's all good. So I let time pass, and in total, Tofu ended up laying 8 freaking eggs! She was not supposed to lay that many. Normally, conures lay clutches of like 4 or 5, so she basically laid 2 birds worth of eggs. I don't know what to do. But all right, she's finally done. We can now move on to the second step in the what to do when your bird lays eggs without your permission plan. I have to swap out the eggs for fake ones. If I just yoink Tofu's eggs away, she's gonna be like, What the f- My eggs? Dude, what the hell? I just laid those. And she's biologically programmed to start laying more to replace them. Luckily, my friends Jordan and Kelsey had some fake Conure eggs because coincidentally, their bird laid eggs like 6 months prior to Tofu, so they already went through this process and were definitely supplying me with mental support. They lent me their fake eggs, I swapped them out, and perfect. Tofu is now trying to be a mother of 8 balls of plastic. After a few weeks of them not hatching, she'll move on, forget all about them, and everything will return to normal. It was a successful heist, as in I gave them both treats, stole all their eggs right in front of them, and they did not notice. You might be realizing, even though Tofu's eggs won't hatch, I still am in possession of actual real bird eggs that may or may not be fertilized. Yep, as much as Ari could have been the mother, he could also be the father. We don't know. Big drama. Are you the father? More like, is there even a father? After consulting with the vet and various bird resources, I basically had to make sure no birds could start growing in them just in case. Even though it's very likely they were just empty little chicken eggs, we couldn't run the risk. By the various resources aforementioned, I was given a few options. I was told I could smash them, which felt a tad bit too violent for me. Aw, Tofu, are these your little eggs? The first eggs you've ever laid in your life? Absolutely not. I could freeze them, just put them in a little container, pop them in the freezer, and there you go. But the last option, which sounded the most insane in my opinion, was to boil them. Make tiny little boiled eggs. Why does that one sound the most deranged and psychopathic? I know people consume all types of bird eggs all over the world, but boiling my own Conure's eggs just feels way past the line in mental sanity. So I popped them in the freezer to hang on to whatever humanity I had left after all this, and they've been there ever since. I still have them. I'll go to grab a popsicle and be like, oh, hello, tofu eggs. I don't know. Even though they won't hatch, they still feel special. They're my little baby tofu's little baby eggs. I don't want to just throw them away like they're nothing. I'll just keep them in my freezer forever because that's somehow the most sane option I was given. Some people might be like, Jaden, you should have tried to let them hatch. But you do not understand. I am absolutely, definitely not qualified to raise baby birds. I promise this was the best thing to do for everyone. For me, for the eggs, for Ari and Tofu. God knows Ari would have been an awful father. Or mother. So that's what I've been dealing with over the past few months. Tofu's fine now, she's essentially back to normal. I have since removed the secret nest drawer they have claimed. I'm sure they weren't too happy about that one, but hey, you reap what you sow. People will tell me, oh, you're the reason I want a bird. And I always think to myself, man, well, that's unfortunate. The majority of people are not suited to own a bird. Case one, they can cut through furniture like chainsaws. Case two, they could lay eggs and curse you to put them in the freezer like the egg murderer you are. Or worse. I love my birds with all my heart, but if anyone ever asks me if they make good pets, I turn into the biggest hater. And if you're a good bird owner, you'd probably agree with me. Birds are beautiful, intelligent, loyal companions, but they're also knife tornadoes who can force you to question your own mortality as you spend a fortune on vet bills. Do you ever think to yourself, man, why is it so hard for me to just do the things I need to do and focus and remember things and manage my time and be organized and remember things and not get sidetracked? Ha! Yeah, me neither. When I was a kid, I was pretty much the picture-perfect depiction of a good student. I was well-organized, always turned in my work on time, got good grades. I even did my homework on Fridays instead of procrastinating until Sunday night. Sure, I didn't like studying and found it hard to focus during it, but who didn't? Saying all those qualities put together, that doesn't sound like the brain of someone with any kind of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, does it? I was well-behaved, didn't feel like I struggled much in school, and didn't cause any trouble. That is, up until I moved out of my parents' house for the first time to go to college. Gradually, I started slipping. I began skipping classes a bit when I just didn't feel like going, would wait until the last moment to start classwork, and lost a lot of motivation because I wasn't interested in any of my schoolwork. But overall, even though it was pretty out of character for me, I chalked it all up to the fact I was simply over going to school. At the same time, my YouTube was really kicking off, and all I wanted to do was that. Of course I wasn't gonna be as good of a student when the silly YouTube videos were doing numbers. I finished a single year of college and convinced my parents to let me take a gap year to see where this YouTube thing can take me. Spoiler alert, the gap year turned into me never going back. I'm a college dropout. So great, I've eliminated the boring school part of my life that weighs me down. Now I can go back to being organized with my new exciting passion job, which entails being my own boss and having to manage and assign myself all of my own responsibilities 24/7. Why are the voices not getting quieter? It's almost like everything was going backwards. I was having a much harder time staying organized and focused. If I didn't want to do a certain type of work, I would have to shackle myself down in basically an isolation chamber to be able to get it done. If I found a new interest, it was all I could think about. And why is it so easy to suddenly be on your roof watching a YouTube video on how to know when you need new shingles? I really didn't get it. Child me had it held together more than current me. What went wrong? I could look back and recognize how everything used to be so perfect and easy. Look at tiny Jaden and all her ducks in that row. I used to color code every single binder I owned, and now I don't even know where I placed the $20 I literally just had in my hand 3 minutes ago. I haven't even left the room. Genuinely, where could it fucking go? Despite feeling like I was downward spiraling for multiple years, I never suspected it could be something related to a genetic neurodevelopmental disorder. I just thought I wasn't trying hard enough and being lazy, or applying myself like I used to. Oh, the woes of turning into an adult, I suppose. Maybe the best years of your life truly are in high school. How upsetting. I didn't even enjoy those either. But then one day I got a text from my brother. I got diagnosed with ADHD. It was a pretty big surprise for me because growing up, he never really seemed to show any of the typical symptoms you associate with ADHD. You know, people would always describe ADHD to me as super hyper kids who would run around the room and scream and generally be a lot. That wasn't my brother. He was quiet and well behaved like I was. But when he started explaining his symptoms, the gears started turning. Yeah, I've always struggled a lot with focusing in school and having things hold my attention when it's boring. But like, I could hyperfix on things I'm interested in and get really passionate about that stuff. Hearing him talk about his personal symptoms of ADHD made a lot of sense, and I felt very freshly educated on the topic. And you'd think that I would immediately start looking into getting a diagnosis for myself, because if you were paying attention, my brother's experiences all sounded very similar to the same struggles I've been having in my own life, but related to work instead of school, because I dropped out. But nope, I was just like, good for you, bro, happy for you. Or, I'm sorry, I don't know. Anyway, back to struggling to simply open up my drawing program as if two blocks of iron were welded to my wrists. Imbalance of brain chemicals? Nah, this just happens from time to time. It's normal. Just the laziness kicking in. I hate Mondays, am I right? Even though I didn't instantly think there was a possibility of me also having ADHD, the mental seed was planted. It's genetic, so I knew subconsciously it ran in the bloodline. It took a few years after my brother was diagnosed for me to really sit down with myself and consider that I, too, could have ADHD. Shocking revelation, I know. Foreshadowing, where did you come from? Things in the focus and productivity department were just getting worse and worse. I had the attention span of a cartoon dog, would completely forget things as soon as they entered my head, would hyperfixate on random stuff like an addict, and there was constant civil war happening inside my head to get one thing done, even though I knew it would only take like 15 minutes. You don't understand. It feels like physical torture to make myself sit down and lip sync a simple scene, like most of the time. You know, the thing I've been doing for 10 years at this point and am definitely used to doing. And yeah, once I've gotten going, then I'm honed in and you have to pry me away from it with a crowbar. I'm aware of that part. But nah, I'm still gonna scrap with myself to plant my ass in that chair because I don't even know why at this point. The biggest thing holding me back from feeling like I had ADHD has always been the simple memory of being in school and having my shit together. I know what it feels like to be on top of things and to be organized. I had it all in the palm of my little child hand. I just needed to summon it again with a bit more effort. But a light switched off in my brain and suddenly I'm just not capable of the things I used to be, and it feels pathetic. Simple tasks are such a mental burden. It feels like I'm out of control but can't do anything about it. So finally, I figured I would try and get myself diagnosed. What did I have to lose? If anything, they just tell me, no, you don't have ADHD. Try a little harder and stop complaining. And yes, of course it took me like 8 months after deciding to get diagnosed to schedule the actual appointment. What did you expect? That's like the first checkmark box on the ADHD list. I started seeing a psychologist and he would ask the typical, do you have a hard time focusing? And I'd go, yeah, like this one time yesterday, and then he writes something down as I continue rambling on this hyper-specific example way too long for a neurotypical person. I met with him for a few weeks, and then it came down to diagnosis day. The nerves, man. I was so ready for him to say I'm a normal person who needs to suck it up, but instead, he was like, okay, so yeah, you definitely exhibit symptoms of someone with the inattentive type of ADHD. And autism. Yippee! My struggles are justified! I'm not crazy! Wait, what was that last part? He explained all the different ways ADHD affects me and the different areas I struggle with compared to others. He even gave me a 37-page document of his conclusions and information on how my brain works, with graphs and pictures. I've read through it all a bunch of times now, and it's already really helped me understand how I tick. I call them the autism docs, but I'm not gonna get into that side of the diagnosis. Let's just brush that one away for now. There's a couple types of ADHD you can have: hyperactive, inattentive, and combined, which is both hyperactive and inattentive. Hyperactive is the type people typically go to when they think of a loud kid who can't sit still. People with this kind normally need to fidget, have low patience, tend to talk a lot, and have trouble staying seated, especially when they're expected to, like in a meeting or school. Inattentive is the one where someone experiences difficulty in focus, memory, organization, has a low attention span. That's the one I have. It's self-explanatory, but if you have the combined type of ADHD, then you got it all. ADHD jackpot right there, my friend. I brought up during the appointments that I used to be such a good kid in school with seemingly zero ADHD symptoms, and how that part has always confused me. And he had a couple hypotheses about it. One, since my mom has always been a big source of my organizational influence, I was able to depend and lean on her for the majority of my school life for it. I felt like I was naturally capable of staying on top of things because she was right behind me the whole time, reminding me and guiding me through stuff. So when I moved out, everything started crumbling, which lines up pretty perfectly to when I did start struggling. Another explanation he gave was the fact that ADHD affects women differently than men, which is also less researched. Love to hear that one. Not only do women tend to be able to mask their symptoms better than guys, so it goes much more unnoticed, but they also experience ADHD differently. And research says there's a chance it can just start affecting women later in life. I'm no ADHD scientist though, that's just what I've been told by specialists. I don't know, I've just got the dang thing. Either way, those two explanations make a lot of sense to me and have since put my weird ADHD imposter syndrome to rest. I didn't really think that getting a diagnosis would change much about how I go about my life, but since getting my ADHD certificate and lollipop, it's completely revolutionized how I think and go about getting things done. It's still hard to get my ass into gear when I need to do one normal thing that's not difficult, but I'm much less hard on myself and will strike almost like these kinds of mental deals to loophole myself into getting things done. Like, for example, if I really don't want to edit a video, I'll say to myself, okay, I know it's gonna be super hard for me to immediately start that task, so I'll get myself into the mindset of getting things done by doing a simple other task I don't find difficult, like cleaning my room. That way, I'll feel productive and can transition that into tackling the original task much easier. It doesn't always work, but it's the mindset change and overall understanding that sometimes I'm gonna have to go about things in different ways that's helped me a lot. Also, after being diagnosed with ADHD, I didn't have much desire to get medicated. I figured just knowing I have it would be enough to get things into gear, and I didn't really need medication that badly. But the content creator in me also thought, well, if I'm gonna write a script about having ADHD, it would be nice to be able to talk about what it's like to be medicated, even just for a day. So I got prescribed good old classic instant release Adderall. Instant release means I don't have to take it every day. I can just take it when I need to get stuff done. It affects me immediately and then wears off after a few hours. There's also extended release, which is the kind you take every day and gives you a constant steady stream of medication. It wasn't until I had the Adderall in my hands when I realized the idea of taking it for the first time made me nervous. Like, what is this thing gonna do to me? I have so many friends with ADHD, honestly a higher ratio than friends without it. That's how it goes in content creation. All these MFs have it. They were all telling me that it's awesome, how you'll take it and immediately feel like a god, and you can do anything, and it's incredible. And yeah, that sounds great, but also like, what the hell? What do you mean I take this little pill and suddenly all of my problems seemingly disappear and I gain superpowers? That's scary. That sounds like the thing every adult in a 20-mile radius warned us about when we were kids. Am I gonna feel like a completely different person? I don't know if I'm ready to experience immortality. I put off taking Adderall for so long because I was irrationally scared of the tiny blue pill, but coincidentally, I really needed to get a script done. If I take too long to write a video script, then the team runs out of work to do, and then I have a bunch of people sitting around and waiting for me to give them more work so they can pay their bills and survive and stuff. But for the freaking life of me, I just could not get myself to sit down and write that script. My body and soul found it mentally easier to backflip off a bridge than write words on the computer. After literally 2 months of my brain going, "Ooh, you better write that script. I won't let you enjoy a single moment of your life if you aren't writing that script." I don't wanna. Get up, go to the bridge. After that constant loop, I finally swallowed my fears and took my first Adderall. I had talked to James a lot about what Adderall is like since he's been on it for a few years now. And after I took one, I was messaging him like, "I did it. I ate an Adderall. How long does it normally take to start? How do I know? What do I do?" And he was helping me a lot and giving me tips. Then, like 20 minutes later, I felt it. All the non-stop thoughts going on in my brain went silent. I could think clearly and in like a line. My mind wasn't racing a mile a minute. I was able to sit behind my laptop and write. It was incredible. I was messaging all my friends about it the entire time. I can write my script and not get distracted. I don't have to take a mental break every 10 minutes. I can remember things. Kelsey sent me a message and I thought, I'll check that in a bit. And I remembered to check in it a bit and respond. When I opened a new tab to look something up, I didn't go down a random unrelated rabbit hole. I picked up my phone to check something and didn't impulsively scroll Twitter for an hour. I can write words so easily. How am I doing this? What do you mean I can feel like this whenever I want if I just eat the tiny blue pill? I refuse to believe regular people can function like this on a day-to-day basis. No way. It wouldn't be fair. You guys don't have loud, non-stop voices in your heads preventing you from doing normal things? Come on, just admit it. You can't pick something up and immediately keep remembering what you were supposed to be doing with it. You always forget and feel crazy. Come on. Come on. I was so suspicious that on Adderall, either nothing would happen and I just wouldn't feel anything, or I would feel like I'm a totally different person experiencing some higher than life manic episode. But no, I just felt like myself, but with my shit together. And that's the part I couldn't believe. After 2 months of war, I finally was able to plant myself down and write my damn script. You wanna know what script I wrote while experiencing Adderall for the first time? This one. I was struggling to write a script about ADHD, and the thing that finally pulled it out of me was Adderall. You gotta admit that's funny. Yeah, it was great. I didn't think my head was loud before, or I was that impulsive, or had that hard of a time focusing. But now that I've been able to peacefully sit in one spot for hours and not need to take a break or check social media or get distracted by some stupid tangent I don't actually care about, yeah, this changes things. I still can't believe what I was able to accomplish. Writing a script in 3 hours. compared to my typical 12 hours, aka one mediocre thing with no struggle at all. And you want to know what I did right after I wrote this script? I immediately got up and cleaned the bird's room without rotting in bed for 3 hours beforehand. I just went from one task to another without thinking about it. All you neurotypical people must be thinking I'm literally pathetic and useless, but I know my ADHD brethren are out of their chairs right now hearing that. I'm not standing before you all to give you scientific data and information on ADHD or diagnose you or even promote prescribed drugs. I'm just here to talk about a big and recent experience in my life, how much of an impact and effect it's had on me, and how awesome feeling normal is. Seriously, being able to take a deep breath in mental silence is incredible. Cherish that feeling if you don't have a neurodevelopmental disorder. It took me 26 years to realize my woes were not actually woes, but symptoms of brain chemical deficiency. I'm writing this video, all things considered, pretty recently after being diagnosed, and I'm still trying to learn how to rebuild my life in a way that lets me optimize my productivity and get things done at a normal level. But so far, I've come so much further than I thought I could simply by knowing what's going on up there in the old noodle. And Adderall. If you're on the fence about being diagnosed with something, I get it. It's scary. It's scary to think you might have it, and it's also scary to think you might not have it. It's an odd place to be. But for me, having a concrete answer from a professional is what got me to finally stop feeling stuck in place and actually start moving forward again. It's been great. I'm excited to keep learning more things about how my mind works and find new ways to improve my day-to-day life. Cheers to getting normal shit done. For people who have been around for a while, you might be seeing the title and thinking, Jaden, aren't you allergic to cats? And to that, I'd say, yes. Kind of. I'm actually not sure anymore. And for the people who know anything about me, you might see the title and think, Jaden, cats are literally the number one natural predator to birds. And to that, I also say, yes, that one's 100% proven fact. So let me back up a bit and explain how we got here, because all the cards in the world were stacked against the idea of me getting a cat. Growing up, I was irrefutably and absolutely allergic to cats. My best friend had like 3 of the things, and every time I would hang out or sleep over at her house, I would be a sneezy, watery-eyed, snotty mess. Can I have some water? Given the fact my brother was also allergic to cats, it was set that we were a dog family. My whole life I went around not giving cats a second thought. I never had anything actually against them, but since I was forced to stay 20 feet away from them or suffer the consequences, I just couldn't get to know them. Plus, as a kid, dogs were always more appealing. They're more likely to be bigger fans of playing and running around, be more approachable with their genetically bred unconditional love, and can overall be more forgiving. Cut to like 2 catless decades for me later, and I'm meeting Jacob for the first time at his place. As we're hanging out in his living room, his cat Fraser comes over and greets me. Fraser is extremely social and vain, so he's always expecting nothing less than a never-ending stream of attention from the people. Even though he's very cute and distinguished, I deployed my typical foolproof plan of don't touch the cat. Fraser realizes he's not getting any attention out of me and sits down nearby on the couch. But a bit later, Jacob's other cat ends up making an appearance. This one's Taylor. She's normally really shy and hides, but does really like women. Which I am. Taylor ended up crawling onto me and making herself really comfy in my womanly lap. Jacob, knowing I'm allergic, offered to take her away, but this was actually the first time a cat has ever done something like this to me. I've always been a bit of a cat magnet, if you want to call it that, because I act like they don't exist, which they interpret as me not pushing their boundaries and creating a comfortable environment for them to come up to me on their own terms, but never have I felt like a cat has chosen me like this before. I told Jacob I'm happy to let her stay comfortable on me, and I'll just reap the consequences of my sowing later on. This was my first extremely positive experience with the cat, and I honestly felt really happy and special and wanted to enjoy it. A few hours later, I'm saying my goodbyes, and during the drive back home, I realized I was completely fine. No sneezing, no itchy eyes, straight up nothing. I was so confused. and curious. Thus, the start of my little cat experiment began. Every time I went over to Jacob's place, I would let the cats be as social as they wanted with me. If Taylor wanted to sit by me, I'd let her. If Frasier wanted attention, I would pet him. At one point, while we were watching a movie, Taylor literally decided to lay down on my neck, filling every one of my breaths with cat dander and hair. And you know what happened? No reaction! Not even a little drip of mucus! Somehow, sometime, I'd grown out of my cat allergy and never noticed. Apparently, every 7 years, people's allergies have the chance to change. Maybe being surrounded by my friends' cats all throughout my childhood could have helped my body get more familiar with them. Either way, I've now unlocked the skill to survive cats. Oh, guys, it was incredible. Now that I'd been freed from my shackles, I immediately started taking time to get to know cats more. Instantly, they felt so much more cute and cool and approachable, and I was really starting to like them more, especially since every time I would hang out at Jacob's place, Taylor would walk over and be around me and purr, and oh, it was amazing to be loved by a cat. So I really like cats now. And after some time, I decided I wanted one too. Jacob and I decided to peruse a local cat rescue's website just to see what cats were available. I don't want to get one right away. There's a lot I have going on, but it doesn't hurt to, oh my god, that one. I want that one so bad. It's so cute. What's its name? Tostada. Tostada. Tostada, my beloved. We have to send in an application. We have to. Hi, my name's Jane. I love this cat. Please let me adopt it. Please, 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 please. What? You guys know me. I'm weak-willed and impulsive. My first mistake was liking cats to begin with. The rescue reached out a few days later for a cat screening interview to make sure we would be a good fit to be cat parents. After being approved, they told us we could pick any cat we wanted that was in their care. Of course I asked about Tostada, but we were given the unfortunate news that she had already been adopted. No! We looked at the other cats available on their website, but unfortunately, none of them really stood out to me. The rescue ended up inviting us to a little Meet the Cats event they were hosting where we could see all the cats they had up for adoption in person, which was awesome because that was actually the first time I'd ever actually seen and held a kitten before. It was amazing. But as cute and tiny as they all were, there still wasn't one that called to me. I pried Jacob away from the kittens, headed home, and we started waiting. Every day I would check the rescue's cat list to see if any new ones caught my eye. I didn't even know what I was looking for, but waited for the universe to send me my perfect cat nonetheless. One morning I refreshed the page and saw one new kitten added. A tortie they found in some dumpster named Scrabble, with the biggest eyes and forehead I'd seen in my life. Something about this bizarre little creature called to me. I messaged the rescue about Scrabble, and they told me she's available, putting me in touch with Scrabble's foster parents. Every day, they sent me new little pictures of kitten Scrabble, and every photo I fell more and more in love with her. She seemed so silly and playful and those eyes. We got on a video call and they told me all about how big of a personality she has. Out of the 5 other kittens they were fostering, she was by far their favorite. The whole time we were talking, Scrabble was flipping around in their arms and looking at the camera with her giant orbs. I left that call knowing I found my cat. I needed to have little kitten Scrabble. Meeting her in person only cemented it. She was shy at first, but after flinging around her worm toy, she immediately started hopping around and being the life of the party. I talked a lot to her foster parents and they just gushed about how they wished they could keep her since they all loved her so much. Even though the rescue called her Scrabble, obviously that was more of a placeholder name, the foster parents called her Cammy, but neither of those really fit to me. However, I knew one name that I liked. Tostada. Yeah, I stole another kitten's name and pasted it on mine. So what? Big deal. Tostada is a great name. My Tostada is way more of a Tostada than the other Tostada anyway. Look at her. I would have left with little Tostada in my arms that moment if I could. But unfortunately, Jacob and I were going out of town for 3 million weeks and had to wait to take her home until after we came back. She was all I could think about the entire time. I was shoving Tostada photos in everyone's face every chance I got. The foster parents were sending Tostada updates every day. I was overflowing with yearning for this cat. She was growing and learning about the world without me. Take me home to my child. Literally, the moment Jacob and I landed, landed, we drove straight from the airport to the foster home to pick her up. I could not wait. We arrived home with plus one Tostada. I couldn't believe it. I have a mammal now. And sorry, other mammal owners, but it's the best mammal in the whole wide universe. Jacob and I spent the entire day playing with her, letting her get used to her new surroundings. She was so cute and so tiny. Here's a video of her eating wet food with a big old chomp. As someone who's owned birds for 7 years at that point, it felt so strange to have a pet that was significantly less fragile. And also draws significantly less blood. You mean this thing can't fly up and get hit by the ceiling fan? Insane! I've had Tostada for a while now. She's 2 years old at the time of me posting this. And let me tell you, this thing has become a creature. First of all, eyes, still giant. And she never blinks. Look at this. She was sitting on my desk looking like that long enough for me to notice, get my phone out of my pocket, pull up the camera app, put the camera in her face, and take a photo. And here's like four more. She is also not that smart. I'm sure you could deduce that by how she looks, but this thing has a single brain cell and it's just another version of herself up there with a joystick. Jacob and I are fully convinced she can only form a few thoughts a day and only in single word nouns. Evidently, Tostada is also very scared of everything, always has been. Loud noises, quiet noises, no noises, movement of any kind. Even Jacob, a person she's been around all her little life post dumpster. There's been times where he'll be at his desk, moves his chair just a smidge, and she's darting out of the room. One time we were trying to explain to some friends how skittish she genuinely can be, and demonstrated it by grabbing a toy literally in front of her, raising it up a bit, lightly dropping it on the floor, still in front of her, and she bolted. You know how cats are genetically built to be good at balancing? Well, Tostada can't even do that. She trips and falls and misplaces her feet all the time. On multiple occasions, she has tried to walk across my L-shaped desk and just missed and fell down. That's like the one thing that makes a cat, and nope, doesn't hit the mark there either. She's gotten better, but as a kitten, Tostada couldn't even jump. After I built her her first cat tower, I watched as she attempted to jump up to the second level, not quite make it, and had to slam her arms down on the thing to hoist herself up like she was mountain climbing. But oh, is she the sweetest little thing. When I got a cat, I was expecting it to want its own space, come around when it wants, you know, general cat things. But this creature follows me from room to room with those high beams of hers. She sits on my lap while I'm at my computer, lays on my giant Pokemon plushes, mostly just looks up at me from the floor and just stares. When I'm sleeping, she'll just crawl into bed and tuck herself up right next to me. Look at all these photos of her straight up on me when I'm sleeping. Don't look too close though, I don't have makeup on. Bedtime is sacred to her. She loves bedtime. If I'm working late, Tostada will come into my office around 9 or 10 p.m., aka past Tostada bedtime, and just start crying, scratching on my chair, rolling around on the floor. It's pitiful. And if I still don't move after that, she'll go into the bedroom and drag over her string toy she always plays with. It's just so sad and pathetic. I always play string with her when she brings it over though, don't worry. But lately, she's picked up another routine habit, which is pats. Not all cats like the pats, but Tostada lives off them. It's when you just slap a cat's butt and it looks like you're hurting them, but they actually love it. However, Tostada's really particular about pats. First of all, I'm the only one allowed to give her pats. Jacob has tried and she runs away scared and offended every single time. Second, she has to receive pats on a specific spot on the floor of the closet. If I try to give her pats in, like, my office, she bolts to her floor spot, staring at me to continue them over there. Also, she begs to be pat every single night. Like clockwork, she'll sit like a gargoyle in front of the closet and cry pitifully until I come over there. Now, when I finally come over for pats, she'll flop on the floor and start horizontally rock climbing her way across the floor with her claws and tangle herself up in the Ethernet cables while I keep up the pats. You think I'm joking, but I'm very much not. This is the only way she accepts pats, and I have to give them to her every night or else she's miserable. Tostada's world is so small. She's really just around me, Jacob, Taylor, and Frasier, but she loves her simple family so much. When kitten Tostada first met Frasier, she was terrified of him. She'd been around other adults adult cats before, but she'd never seen a flat cat in her life, and she was mortified. Of course, she's since warmed up to him, and they play together and hang out all the time, they're best friends, but Tostado loves Taylor. Always has. She looks up to Taylor like a little baby sister admiring her cool, awesome older sibling. Unfortunately, Taylor hates it. They literally have a SpongeBob Squidward type of sibling relationship, and Tostada is so oblivious to it. Taylor has annoyingly swatted at Tostada so many times just for existing around her that Tostada now thinks it's a fun little game they play and will start chasing and swatting back at Taylor happily, not understanding cat's social cues. Of course, never in a way that's too far, but just enough to get on Taylor's nerves even more. Between the three of them, they all have such different little personalities and relationships to each other. It's made our lives so much more entertaining. And to anyone concerned about the birds, don't worry. I've got Ari and Tofu very separated from the cats. They're safe in their own blocked off room connected by a double door system that ensures no possible interaction between bird and cat. If anyone is thinking about getting cats and birds as pets, it is possible, but just make sure the two are very separate, especially if you have smaller birds like conures or budgies. I'm sure there's people out there that have trained their cats to be fine around a pet bird, but to me, all it takes is one accident or attack for you to just not have a bird anymore. Plus, having the two of them takes a huge amount of time and commitment. I've said it before and I'll say it forever, I love my birds to death, but they do not make good pets for the very large majority of people. In terms of allergies, I do think I was originally still a little bit allergic to Tostada, ironically. When I first got her, I was sneezy and sniffling. Nothing allergy pills couldn't fix, and it never was as bad as my original cat allergy. But I think I've been growing out of that one too, because nowadays I don't have any reaction to her at all. Bodies are a mystery. I am building my immunity to everything. Next up is rat poison. I didn't think I would make a video talking about this thing, but Tostada's just got such a funny little personality and has become such a big part of my life. She may be the description of autism, but I love her more than the world itself, and I know I'm the center of her little life too. I don't even see her as a cat. She's just a little creature that follows me around looking weird, but I love it, and I'm so glad I grew out of my cat allergy just so I can have her. When Carl Jacobs popped up in my DMs asking if I wanted to be in Mr. Beast's upcoming video, I'll be honest, my gut reaction was fear. Mr. Beast has basically become YouTube's own mad scientist. He can snap his fingers and shape reality at this point. Despite part of me thinking I should just stay in the comfort of my own home, I felt really honored to be invited and kinda just wanted to show up, say hi, and then realistically go home within the first round of eliminations. I accepted the ominous invitation and before I knew it was flying to North Carolina being handed a custom uniform, all before even knowing what I actually just signed up for. I didn't even know if there was a prize for the winner at this point. Walking into the green room, I was expecting to not know anyone, but to my relief, I saw a lot of familiar faces. I even used this time to ask MatPat what it was like to meet Scott Cawthorn, and he told me FNAF secrets. So already, this trip was more than worth it. Eventually, we were herded down a long, mysterious hallway until we saw it. The Mr. Beast Cube. After everyone was filed inside, we were told the last person to leave the cube would be deemed the winner. And also win $1 million for their subscribers. This is for $1 million? The challenge began. Immediately, people started jumping in the giant pile of real money that was inside, throwing handfuls of bills in the air, laughing, mingling. To pass the time, James and I drew our cartoon characters out of dollar bills on the floor. The staff came in and ended up giving everyone their own personal vlog camera to document their POV of the challenge. And I think I genuinely was the only person who didn't record a single second of footage on that thing. I just thought, I'm not gonna use this footage because I'm not gonna make a video out of it, and they're gonna have plenty of other people's footage to use. In hindsight, maybe it would have been a good idea to record something, just in case. I don't know, maybe the Mr. Beast team would end up actually wanting to use some of my footage. Who's to say? After maybe an hour or two, Jimmy came out for the first bonus challenge, a single free throw. Miss and you're eliminated, but make it, and not only do you get to come back into the cube, you also win a Cybertruck for one of your subscribers. They had 50 people subscribe subscribers just in a room waiting for something to happen. I'll be honest, when Jimmy explained the extra credit challenge, I was like, hell no, I'm not going up to miss a free throw and leave immediately after nothing's happened yet. If my subscriber back there knew what was going on, they 100% would have understood they weren't getting called up for nothing. If I remember correctly, maybe 2 people ended up making their baskets and 3 people were eliminated. I could be wrong, I don't remember because I didn't vlog it. While chatting with friends, Ludwig walked up and asked if I wanted to do a dice bet. With nothing else to do, I agreed. And to no one's surprise, I lost. And an evil expression washed over Ludwig's face. Alright, since you lost, I want you to walk up to Kai Sanat and introduce yourself with, "Hi Kai, I'm Jaden. So which of my videos have you seen?" Maybe I should have just missed a free throw. "Hey Kai, there's someone I want you to meet." "Hey man, I'm Jaden. Nice to meet you. So which of my videos have you seen?" "Excuse me? Holy shit, I'm gonna kill myself." "Oh, so which of my videos have you seen?" "Oh, I'm sorry, I haven't seen any, I don't think." "Ha! That's okay. Nice meeting you, bye!" Kai was super chill and nice about it, but oh my god, I wanted to rip my skin off. I'm stuck in this cube with him until further notice, and it's all Ludwig's fault with his stupid dice! I hate it in here, let me out! Oh, hi Jimmy. We were told to gather up in groups of 5, designating one as a team captain who will have immunity for the next challenge. I was with James, Schlatt, Ludwig, and Charlie Moist Critical, using the dice to choose the captain. This time, I actually rolled highest, but reassigned it to Ludwig because I couldn't cope with the idea of possibly being responsible for a teammate's elimination. And then it was revealed captains would just have to assign their teammates a shape for the Squid Game Honeycomb Challenge. Okay. Well, I definitely overthought that one. I had triangle, James got circle, Charlie was star, and Schlatt unfortunately got umbrella. The 10-minute timer began, and everyone started deploying various different strategies to get their cookie shape out. Charlie used a new technique called huck as much spit as you can into the tin to dissolve it all. It was really gross. He ended up filling the tin almost to the top with spit. By the end, 2 people with stars were eliminated, and not a single umbrella made it through. Bye, Schlatt. It was very funny seeing Mr. Beast lift the lid off Charlie's tin and immediately reel back in disgust, though. A total of 14 out of 50 people have now been eliminated, leaving 36 people. Honestly, that was good enough for me. Losing at any point going forward was already further than I was anticipating. We were fed our little thing of rations and left to wait again. It probably doesn't seem like long in Mr. Beast's video, but it was like 9 p.m. by the time we began the second real challenge. After being directed to choose a partner, James and I shook hands, ready to take on the next game as a team, and froze as it was revealed we had just chosen our own opponent. Another Squid Game tactic. I probably should have seen it coming, I just didn't expect the double up. The Beast staff revealed the next challenge as they rolled in a giant Jenga tower. Winner stays, loser walks. Unfortunately, the very first game of giant Jenga between KSI and AJ ended up taking literally 2 hours. Doing the math in our heads, we all kind of figured we probably didn't have the time to play Jenga for the next 30 hours. But just as AJ won, KSI hoisted him over his shoulders and ran out of the cube.
No!
Huge drama! Everyone was freaking out. AJ was stunned. No one knew what to do. Was that legal? Can you just carry people out of the cube? Jimmy had everyone take a vote, and pretty much everyone opted to bring AJ back in. Yes, out of the kindness of our hearts, but also out of fear of being manhandled. So since giant Jenga was a bust, production ended up scrambling to try and find like 12 sets of normal Jenga at midnight in North Carolina. A feat that seems impossible, but I feel like Jimmy could just call up the president of Jenga and have it all delivered via helicopter within 30 minutes. It took a bit, but the slightly larger than normal, yet still reasonably sized Jenga towers were all set up. As our game was going on, James and I ended up making a pact that whoever was eliminated would relay to the outside world that the other was okay. Because we didn't have our phones, by the way. Our friends only knew we were in the Mr. Beast cube and haven't responded for 14 hours. Our game of Jenga was pretty intense. Eventually, it got to the point where as I was watching James pull out a final piece, I realized there wasn't any left for me to safely remove. I'm about to be eliminated. And a flash of bliss washed over me. Sure, I'll be gone, but That's okay. I'll be set free into the outside world again. The cube is harsh, unforgiving. It's taken so many of my friends from me. The glass floor is hurting my butt. I'm ready to go now. And deeper into the trenches I went. James being eliminated meant I was moving on to Cube Day 2. What a miracle. Watching the rest of the Jenga games was like watching an active war zone. People were focusing, cheering, sweating, praying. Towers were falling one after the other at the feet of now eliminated players. It was brutal. And also still taking way too damn long, man. Can I go to bed? The last game left to finish was between Quackity and a popular Brazilian creator, Enaldino. Apparently, when it was revealed the challenge was Jenga, Enaldino turned to Quackity and admitted he was a Jenga pro. Quackity had never played. Not the situation you want to be in. Quackity half-jokingly asked Enaldino if he wanted to play rock, paper, scissors instead, to which he replied, no. Which, you know, fair. But 3 hours into this single game, the two of them were neck and neck. Genuinely the most cracked round of Jenga possibly ever. Everyone in the cube was gathered around watching Quackity slowly pulling out the very last piece in this skeleton of a Jenga tower. Just as he was about to make it, Enaldino asked, rock, paper, scissors? Quackity looked up at him.
Muito tarde.
It was over. Enaldino tried to hang in there, but in the end, he fell. 18 people were now eliminated. Alright, it's 3 a.m., let's go to bed. I genuinely thought they would let us go back to our hotel rooms for the night, but... Man, now this is just great. I won myself a ticket to a night in the Mr. Beast Cube, sleeping next to a bunch of people I barely know, and I was probably just gonna get eliminated first thing in the morning anyway. As I was getting ready for bed, Kai walked by. Hey, I gotta check out your videos sometime. Oh, I'm sorry, man. I lost a bet to Ludwig, and he made me say that. Oh, shit. Okay, damn. Oh, well, that makes falling asleep a bit easier. Thank God he only thought I had a huge ego for 19 hours straight. Crisis averted. In the morning, production had to prep for filming again, which meant they turned on every single light in the building, flashbanging all of us. They were turned off, and then these loud-ass brrrr sounds from construction started blasting. They turned the lights on again a few minutes later, but this time in a crazy strobe light effect for some reason. After breakfast rations, Jimmy returned, pointed to the entrance hallway, and in walks I Show Speed, with too much energy for a group of people that just had the weirdest sleep of their lives. Alright, you guys have the chance to vote Speed into the cube to join you in challenges. The kind thing to do was to let him in, but we all just survived trenches no one could even understand. We were trauma bonded together. And also, it wouldn't be fair. The majority of us moved to the voting side of no. Admittedly, me too. Mainly because I was a bit scared of him. Speed looked at Kai. At least shake my hand, man. You're gonna pull me out. As the two of them argued about a friendly handshake, Ludwig stepped up. I'll shake your hand, Speed. His hand now extended to Ludwig. The moment their hands touched, Speed started yanking Ludwig towards the outside world. We all started screaming and panicking. We couldn't lose one of our cute brothers like this. Ludwig was holding onto the support beam for dear life. Some of the guys managed to pull him back in, and as Speed walked out, unable to take any souls with him, he exclaimed, "This ain't the last time you're gonna see me, and I remember all y'all's faces." Alright, let's get started. Challenge 3 was Steal or No Steal. Basically, a modified version of Deal or No Deal. Some cases have the word safe in them, others say eliminated. One person looks inside a selected case, and the other decides whether they want to steal it or no steal it. And also, Howie Mandel was there.
Hi, Howie, big fan.
People started getting eliminated one by one, others securing safety. Eventually, Ludwig was up at the podium asking if anyone wanted to volunteer to go up. At this point, the ratio of safe cases was very high. 60% in favor of safe. Figuring the odds would just get messier from there, I volunteered. Ludwig looked inside his chosen case, looked up, and told me it was safe. I knew mathematically I should steal the case, but I've been burned by math before. As I started hesitantly saying I was gonna steal, Mr. B suddenly burst out saying Ludwig's heart rate was spiking. By the way, he was wearing a heart rate monitor, which made me scared it was actually an elimination case, and he was excited at the idea of avoiding going home. So last minute, I decided to let him keep the case. It was the safest play. If it said eliminated, then good, I dodged a bullet. If it was safe, then at least I'm not actually eliminated yet. I just have to play again. Shit. It was now my turn to bring someone up. Even though I didn't want to pick a friend out of fear of getting them eliminated, more than that, I didn't want to be up there with someone I didn't know. I picked Quackity. He came up to the podium. I grabbed case number 2. It says safe. My plan was to tell the truth, but in the most unconfident and nervous way possible. I was deploying every bit of body language knowledge I could think of, making myself look as guilty as possible as he asked me various questions. We went back and forth for a bit until your eyes looked down as you said the case was safe, which indicates guilt. So I think you're lying. I'm not gonna steal it. Without a word, I shifted the case onto its back, unlatched it. Safe. It was worth sleeping in the cube! Oh my god, the relief, you have no idea. After everything finished, a bunch of people walked out, and unfortunately, Quackity ended up being one of them. 10 people left. I know it's a dog-eat-dog world inside the cube, but when you're left to sit with your fellow contestants for hours on end between challenges, waiting for Jimmy Beast to send you all through another round of cube stress, you really start bonding with the survivors. It was pretty sad watching them go. Hours passed until the Jimmy death bell struck again, and we were told to partner up once more. Alex and I had really gotten to chat and hang out together as the only girls left at this point, so we paired up. Everyone was blindfolded and told to sit tight until they were ready, which is ominous. The two of us were strategizing and figuring out each other's strengths and weaknesses for whatever was coming our way, only to be unblindfolded and see the entire cube transformed into a kitchen. It was a cooking battle. We're actually What? Alex started panicking, saying she can't cook for her life. We were freaking out. Then Mr. Beast brought out the judges. Professional competitive eater Joey Chestnut, Miranda Cosgrove,
my big fan,
and Speed. Bottom two teams are eliminated. Time starts now. We ended up committing to mac and cheese with a slice of chocolate cake under the fancier title of American comfort food. AKA the only two women left in the challenge can't cook and they're trying their fucking best. The judges walked around to check in on everyone, and eventually Speed was at our station. So when you all were voting to let me in, which side were you on? Well, originally we were on the side of no, because we were a bit intimidated, but we ended up switching to a yes at the last minute. Right, Jaden?
Yeah, I switched.
Alright, cool. Because you know I don't forget, right?
Yep.
Later on during the challenge, Mac and Nolan from the Beast team came up to ask what we were making. At the time, I was grating up Feastables to sprinkle onto our cake for decoration, and I thought, oh, it would be funny to have them ask what we're making, and it's just their own brand of chocolate. So I was like, close your eyes and open your mouth, and gave Mac a piece of chocolate, and immediately without chewing, he was like, is this Feastables? And I was like, yeah. And he kind of stood there for a second with his mouth still open, and Nolan was like, oh, he's allergic. And they both had to leave. Oh my god, guys, I felt so bad. I apologized so much when he came back. Mac said it was fine and is a good sport about it, but I still have so much guilt about being such an idiot. Ludwig and Amiksem presented first with their fried chicken and asparagus dish. The judges all really enjoyed it, giving them a total of 26 points, which is really unfortunate because I definitely thought Speed was gonna hold a bigger grudge against Ludwig and tank their score. We were up next, and thankfully, they really liked our food too. Joey was the first to score us, and ended up giving us a 10 out of 10. And in the moment, as a joke, I wanted to turn around and flip off Ludwig as a, like, friendly fake gloat, but I accidentally turned around and flipped off Amiksem, and I felt so bad again. He was not the intended target, and now I was just being rude, and this challenge was going horribly. Not because of the cooking part, I've just been non-stop fumbling socially. We also got a total of 26, putting us at a tie with the French boys. But now, Logan Paul and
and Nick DiGiovanni were presenting. And I haven't mentioned it yet, but Nick is actually a goddamn chef. They even gave us all his own cookbooks as a helpful tip for the challenge, which is just a knife twist in my opinion. So yeah, they knocked it out of the park, got a 29. The judges were licking their plates. After them was Kai and AJ, who had a great presentation, but their food, not so much. They got a 16. After eating, Speed got up and started smashing the plates on the ground. And Logan Paul saw this and got really excited because he wanted to smash plates too. Without thinking, he ran out to join Speed. And we all shouted at him in panic. Confused at the sudden change in the air, Logan looked back at us before realizing he left the cube. To this day, none of us are truly sure if he did it for, like, the content or it was a genuine accident. In his defense, the set was so cosmetically different that it really did feel like we weren't in the cube anymore. Either way, he content created too close to the sun, and even though he had a guaranteed spot in the finals, he was eliminated. The last team of Rubius and Spriter went up with their Spanish tortilla, but turns out Spriter is a huge fan of Speed, so he made a special Thai dessert just for him that the other judges weren't allowed to eat, which is honestly hilarious. We all held our breath as the judges flipped through their scores. 22. Alex and I made it to the finals. I never in my life thought I was gonna be getting this far, and suddenly realized I need to actually think about what I would do if I won. I went into this thing not even knowing if there was a prize at all, and was now facing the reality that I could win the whole thing. Hours passed as the five of us sat together in the cube until Mr. Beast emerged for the final time. Someone was about to win $1 million for their subscribers, and it all came down to this last challenge. Honestly, among the group, there wasn't a single person I thought didn't deserve to win. Everyone left were good people who all wanted to do something really positive with the money. It was great getting to know them all over the course of 2 cube days, and I was really proud to be standing next to them in the finals. 5 briefcases were piled in the center, one for each finalist. We were to each take one, peek inside our chosen case, and within the next 10 minutes, discuss who to vote out. If you're voted out and your briefcase is empty, you're eliminated. But if you're voted out and your case has the $1 million inside, you win instantly. It was basically like reverse Among Us. The first round started, we all grabbed a case, peeked inside. Holy shit, I grabbed the $1 million case round one. I started shaking. I didn't know what strategy to use. I didn't know how to make myself look like I should be voted out. And during the discussion time, it definitely showed because I was really quiet and nervous the whole time. The 10-minute discussion wrapped up. We all unanimously wrote our votes down, and it fell into a tie between voting out Ludwig and somehow me. It could end right here. We had a few minutes to discuss again and recast votes, but Alex and Nick were able to figure out I voted for myself, so Ludwig was eliminated. The cases were reshuffled, we each grabbed one. I pulled it again. In that moment, I froze. Since I was in the hot seat last round, I was probably gonna fly pretty under the radar this time. Someone else is gonna be voted out, and I statistically will not see this case ever again. If I'm not voted out here, I basically lose. The second round began, and it was pretty much a blur from there. I was trying to talk more because being quiet last round got me found out, but was still flying too under the radar. Amidst trying to keep up with the conversation, strategize, and hold myself together, I couldn't find my win con. But with a few minutes left, Amixem said something that I think shifted the entire game. What are the odds Jaden pulled the million case twice? There it was. Gambler's fallacy, save me. Save me, gambler's fallacy. I couldn't mess this up. I don't know what to say to that one. Everyone's attention was now on me, and I could tell they were all thinking about what was just thrown into the ring. We all looked down at our papers. I wrote my name as quietly as possible, worrying the sound of the letters were gonna out me. Jimmy read them all out. Jaden. Alex. Jaden. Jaden. They voted me out. I slowly walked to the middle of the podium with my briefcase. In that moment, I was the only one who knew what had just happened. Everyone leaned in as I unlatched the case. and revealed the million. I won! Confetti cannons blasted, everyone immediately started congratulating me, all the eliminated contestants left in the green room ran out screaming and jumping around me in celebration. I started to tear up for some stupid emotional reason. So, yeah, I won $1 million to give away to my subscribers. That is a Looney Tunes amount of money. First of all, top five all agreed that whoever won the million would give the other four 100k each to do something for their subscribers too. So a total of 400k will be going to Ludwig, Alex Botez, Amixim, and Nick DiGiovanni. With the remaining 600k, I decided to put it towards paying for as many people's art degrees as possible. It's really scary going into the art field right now, between the animation industry hitting their rough patches, AI threatening to take artist jobs. The overall career path is extremely intimidating and difficult to break into. I'd really like to encourage and make it easier for some of the up-and-coming artists by being able to send them through art school stress-free. I have no idea how to set it all up, but I'm currently working with as many qualified people as I have available to me to make it happen. As my and Mr. Beast's team figures it out, I'll keep you all updated through my Twitter. We'll get it sorted. I entered the Mr. Beast Cube ready to just talk to my friends and screw up in the first challenge, but instead I was isolated from the world for 48 hours, watched my peers fall one by one in front of me, and left with $1 million for my subscribers. Thank you, Carl, for inviting me. Thank you to all my friends who made the cube so much more enjoyable. Thank you, Mr. Beast, for creating this incredible opportunity I can now use to support artists. Despite being put through cube trenches, I had a really great time. And of course, huge thanks to the Beast crew for making it all happen. It was something I'll never forget or experience ever again. Hopefully.
One time I was at an arcade and saw someone with an Ari bag, so I went up to them and said, "Hey, I really like your bag." She turned around, looked straight at me, and said, "Thanks, it's from Jaden Animations." "Oh, cool." And then I just walked away because I didn't know how to salvage that interaction without being weird about it. As someone who has somehow amassed big number on YouTube website, you'd probably expect me to be recognized fairly frequently when I'm out on the town. I do definitely get recognized here and there, but given that almost all of the content I've posted is me in cartoon form, it's much less than you'd think. I don't really expect to be recognized unless I'm going somewhere that attracts people who are more online, such as conventions or Hatsune Miku concerts. Of course, I've been in plenty of IRL content on other people's channels, so it's not like no one knows what I look like, but that barrier has given a bit of cushion on how often people will notice that Jaden Animations is in their vicinity. The majority of my fan interactions are very positive and follow this general flow. "Are you Jaden Animations?" "Yeah." "Oh, that's so cool. I love your videos. Can I get a photo?" "Yeah." "Alright, thanks, bye." It's simple, it's streamlined, everyone's happy. Of course, not every interaction goes like this, and naturally, people always want to know about the outliers, the bad interactions, the weird ones. Any freaks out there that you've met, Jaden? I'm lucky enough to be able to say, you guys are pretty normal. There's not really any single experience that comes to mind when people ask me that. So thank you. Gold star to every single person I've met in my entire career so far. However, I do have some funny stories I've collected. Like one time, Jacob and I were sitting down at the Toadstool Cafe to film for their video about Nintendo Land when this one guy walked by and recognized Jacob. "Oh my gosh, are you Alpha Red?" "Yeah." "Oh, that's so cool. I love your videos. Can I get a photo?" "Yeah." You know, everything's going as per the script. At this point, I piped up and asked, "Would you like me to take the photo for you?" And as I said that, Jacob and I both saw that the guy suddenly recognized my voice, and therefore, me. Now knowing there were two YouTubers at that table, he started to ask if I was Jaden, but mid-sentence realized that if he was incorrect, it would look a little tiny bit racist. You know, you can't always just assume the Asian girl with Alpha Red is Jaden, even though 90% of the time you'd be correct. So he ended up pivoting halfway through to cover for the mistake, which ended up like this. "Would you like me to take the photo for you?" "Oh, correct me if I'm wrong, but who are you?" Of course
course, we knew what he meant. I say I'm Jaden, everything is fine, we all take a photo together. But being able to see the line his brain took in real time was so funny. It's one of my and Jacob's favorite stories because he meant so well. Like, I completely understand what happened. But also asking, sorry, but who are you? To someone offering to take a photo is just... I would love to meet that guy again and just tell him how much we loved that interaction. Dude, if you're out there, I hope your Toadstool Cafe food was good. Because ours wasn't. There actually have been times, though, where people have thought they've run into me and were just wrong. I've seen tweets tagging me like, OMG, just met Jaden Animations! As I'm currently sitting at home looking at a photo of some poor random Asian girl. When we were all on tour for Scribble Showdown a while back in Chicago, James and Emily went to go look at the bean, and James ended up getting recognized. While he was talking to the group of people, one of them saw Emily and went, "Oh my gosh! It's Jaden!" James immediately starts laughing his ass off trying to correct them, but somehow wasn't clear enough because when they were all taking a photo, they were like, "Jaden, get in front!" Another time, when Jacob and Joe posted a video of themselves playing Mario Wonder in a GameStop, at the very end, Joe turned the camera around to the girl filming and said, "Are you Jaden Animations?" The bit being it was our friend Sarah Moon, who is not me, but has been called Jaden by confused viewers in the past for really no reason, but still, hundreds of people in the comment section of the video still thought she was me anyway because Asian girl. Then, to poke fun at that situation, a while later they asked me to record them playing Mario Kart in a round one, and in it said, "Huge shout out to Sarah Moon for recording this video," as the camera panned to me. And you'd think people would catch on to the joke, but so many more people were like, "Okay, I thought that was Jaden in the other video, but was afraid of being racist," not realizing they're still not getting it. Sarah and I genuinely look nothing alike, but just pointing at one of us and going, "Jaden," will convince hordes of people in comment sections without fail. It's like casting an inescapable Jaden spell. On the opposite side of the coin, I was in San Diego for TwitchCon last year, perusing the San Diego Zoo with some friends. And honestly, to hype it up a bit, the San Diego Zoo is awesome. I legit went there 3 times during the 3-day event, which, to the math nerds out there, means I went to the zoo more times than the actual convention. Anyway, someone ended up coming up to me with an "excuse me" that I registered as I was being recognized. So I turned around, expecting the typical fan interaction. "Sorry to interrupt, but are you Emeru?" I was stunlocked. It threw off my whole script and I accidentally blurted out, "Oh, no, I'm not. I'm sorry, I'm just Asian." And the guy didn't really have anything to say about that. He just went, "Oh, okay, thanks." You know, it was a nice little dose of humble for me, though. I got a kick out of Emily and Sarah being called Jaden, and now I've been struck by the Emeru hammer. Look, I'll be the one to say it, though. None of us look like each other. We're just Asian women on the internet, and not even the same kind. So yeah, if you ever think you see your favorite Asian creator in the wild, make sure you double check. Sometimes I can tell people are secretly Googling me before asking for a photo, just to be sure. And you know, if that's what it takes, that's what it takes. I didn't mean to go off on this whole tangent about people accidentally being racist. I'm sorry, there were just a lot of instances of it. We can get back on track now. The very first time I was recognized, not in like a convention setting, was in a random Target. I was walking down an aisle chatting with my friend Kelsey when someone passed by, backtracked, and came up asking, "Are you Jaden?" Now, this was back in 2017 when I had significantly less content showing my face, so I was completely shocked and not prepared. I was in ugly house clothes, no makeup, hair wasn't washed, literal bridge dweller, and was in the middle of my first public fan interaction. Apparently, they recognized me from my voice, which is nuts. Some people have told me I sound exactly like how I do in my videos, and others say
I don't, so I have no barometer on what I actually sound like. The person was super sweet. This isn't like a crazy story or anything, but it's special in my mind because I was so embarrassed and unprepared for it, mentally and physically. This next one was when Jacob, Captain Kidd, and I were in Hawaii for Pokemon Worlds. We'd all just arrived at the event and were checking out all the fun decorations Pokemon set up. Since all of us have made a good amount of Pokemon content, a lot of Pokemon fans were recognizing us and asking to take photos. A well-intentioned mom ended up taking notice of how much attention we were getting and asked us what we did for a living for all these people to be coming up to us. Jacob explained we were YouTubers and she lit up, saying her son watches a lot of YouTube, pointing down at the young boy hiding behind her leg. In an attempt to connect with the kid a bit, Jacob asked what YouTubers he watched.
I like Mr. Beast.
Seeing a way to make the kid excited, Jacob pointed at me and said, "No way! Did you know she was in a Mr. Beast video recently and won?" Instantly, the kid jumped up. "You know Mr. Beast?" "Well, like, kinda. I've talked to him before, but..." "Will you tell him to give me $1,000,000? First of all, hilarious situation to suddenly be thrust into. Second of all, now that the kid was suddenly not hiding behind his mom's leg anymore, we could see he had a giant gold chain around his neck, sporting a framed PSA-graded base set first edition Charizard. Little dude, do you know how much cash you've got around your neck right now? The card was graded like 9.5 as well. I have no idea where he got it from. Like, you always see those, can you give me $1,000,000,000 comments on Mr. Beast stuff, but it was surreal to witness it in real life. Like, it's real. Gold chain Charizard Mr. Beast kid has been cemented in my memories, and he didn't even know who we were. Also, for the record, after I won the Mr. Beast cube, my emails were an absolute wreck of random people begging me for money. Can you give me money? May please get some money? Hi, JD. Not my name. Just 10K, thank you. Heart. Someone straight up sent me a PayPal invoice for $10,000 with no message attached. Just an outstretched, grubby little hand in my inbox. Guys, I didn't win any money from that thing. You can stop emailing me. We gave it all away to various artists all over the globe to support them through their art school, which was an incredible opportunity, and I was very happy to support artists, and I wish them all the best of luck with their degrees. But stop emailing me for money! Gosh, I don't even want to know what Mr. Beast's DMs look like. One time, my phone screen died on me, not my fault, so I had to take it to a repair shop. This was, unfortunately, during a time when my car's driver's side mirror was smashed, my fault. So I also had no street legal car to take me back home while I waited for my phone to be fixed. Needing to kill 2 hours, I ended up sitting in a nearby Burger King, equipped with my Switch to play Hello Kitty Island Adventure, and an iPad as a second monitor to watch YouTube videos. I almost made it the entire time with no issue, but like some sort of pathetic Scooby-Doo villain, my plan was foiled as a nice girl came up to me and quickly said, "I really like your videos," before walking back over to sit with her friends. Now, the interaction itself was completely fine. I'm just embarrassed at what it looked like on her end. Internet personality Jaden Animation sitting completely alone at a single seat table in a random Burger King. No food in sight, just a table covered in devices like some sort of 27-year-old iPad kid. She didn't even let me explain my situation, she just said hi and walked off. So, kind girl, if you're out there, or even still a fan, it wasn't as pathetic as it looked. It was pathetic, but it's not that bad. I was just passing the time. Please resubscribe. I feel like I lost you that day. Speaking of unfollowing out of shame, a couple years ago, I went with some friends to my first furry convention. The furry convention isn't the shameful part, though. That itself was great. The actual shame began when my group wanted to check out the 18 plus section, mainly out of curiosity and entertainment. I sheepishly followed them in, and just as I was thinking to myself, man, it would sure be unfortunate if I got recognized while in here. Oh my gosh, are you Jaden Animations? Yeah. So admittedly, there's a single photo out there of me, a fan, and a very, colorful background. Quickly moving on from that one, this story is by far the most I've ever been recognized out in public in my entire life. There's probably a teeny little slight possibility I curated it myself by accident, but it was when I went to a Hatsune Miku concert in California. The community somehow has caught on that I like her, and said community was all right there in one spot. Before the concert, I was getting recognized, like, every few minutes, which is very not normal for me, but, you know, completely fine. I don't mind at all. Eventually, everyone was led into the venue. I was meeting a few more people inside. Then the lights went down, and we all got to enjoy the concert as per usual. However, when the show was over and the lights turned back on, everyone rotated 180 degrees to head to the exit, which meant people could see my face again. We would make it a few steps forward, get stopped, then three more people would come up, and I'd suddenly be against the wall, all while my poor friends just had to watch it all happen and wait for me. For the first time ever, I needed to figure out a way to get out of there, or else I would have been taking photos with the entire concert audience as my friends withered on the floor. Sarah put her big hoodie on me, another friend gave me their sunglasses, and suddenly, I vanished. No more Jaden animations. Poof. She was gone. The Clark Kent strategy actually works. Sarah and I quickly headed to the exit, squishing past unsuspecting Miku fans, and it wasn't until we made it all the way to the parking lot where we turned around and realized we were alone. I was successfully smuggled out, but the downside was the disguise was so overly effective. Even our friends didn't know who I was anymore. At least now I know if I'm ever in a sticky situation, a simple hoodie and glasses is really all it takes. I will no longer be making fun of Superman's public disguise. Dude knew what he was talking about. Despite all of these stories, if you ever see me in public, please don't be afraid to come up and say hi. I'm more than happy to meet you or take a photo. Again, basically every person I've met who watches my videos was absolutely wonderful, these stories included. And I promise I won't make a video about you if you accidentally say something a little awkward. Unless it was really funny and the world needs to know. Also, I can tell when you recognize me, I've essentially got a spidey sense for it by now, and it's more uncomfortable for both of us if you just stare at me for 30 minutes and then leave. Please, just say hi or something. It's okay. I'm lucky to have such a normal and kind group of people watching my content, and I do really enjoy getting to meet you guys. I guess if you were to take anything from this video, make sure you know it's actually me. This is not me. This is not me. This is not me. I'm this one. Hope that helps. Music is a huge part of our society. It brings people together, lets you express yourself in new and creative ways, can even help you get through tough times. Personally, for me, I don't get it. I'm sorry, I've honestly never been a big music person. I know, throw me into a volcano. I would just rather watch YouTube videos. I don't know, I like the constant flashing colors and pictures, I think. Like, I don't hate music. For the most part, I could honestly listen to anything, but that's kinda it, you know? Nothing stands out to me and I don't go out of my way to listen to it. If anyone out there is like me, you understand the pain of when a conversation starts turning towards the topic of music. You know exactly what's coming, and you're helpless to stop it. There's nothing you can do. It's already in motion. The person you're talking to opens their mouth and you wince as they say it. So what kind of music do you listen to? Oh, I don't really listen to music. Like, not at all. Nah, maybe like some video game music every once in a while, but that's kind of it. Damn. that's crazy. Yeah. And after that conversational stumbling, the person starts talking about the music they like, and you have to stand there and take it. Oh, that sounds cool. I should give it a listen. You're just lying through your teeth, not being convinced in the slightest, and will immediately forget every piece of information they tried to feed you. Even if I wanted to look it up later, my brain goes, get this out of here immediately. We've got to make room for the 4-hour-long video essay about Freddy Fazbear. Basically, I don't connect to music the way the majority of people do, and no one, including me,
is happy about it. Look, I've tried to contribute in my own way, but no one else listens to the Mario Kart Cheese Land theme in their free time. It's good, no one believes me. Now, on a completely unrelated note, a while ago I wanted to get into a hobby that was fun and active at the same time, because I do not move if not incentivized to. And that's not good. I'd like to still be fully functional at the age of 30. So after a bit of soul searching and digging around in the old ideas jar, I decided to try out DDR. I got a dance pad, downloaded some fun video game songs and anime intros to Dance Dance Revolution 2, and I got really into it. It was the most active I've been since high school. I was doing cardio for hours on end. Who am I? After playing my batch of custom songs for a few months, I decided to download some more stuff. And that's when I casually thought to myself, I wonder if there's any good Vocaloid charts. Now to start a completely new tangent again, Vocaloid is a voice synthesizer program, yada yada yada. Basically, it's robot voices you can control to write songs, and there's different characters based on what voice you use. The most common example, you know her, you love her, is Hatsune Miku. Yep, strap in folks, we're finally talking about Hatsune Miku, my beloved. My history with Hatsune Miku is a bit all over the place. I first got really into her in high school. I don't remember exactly how, but I probably just stumbled onto some of her popular songs while browsing YouTube one day. Either way, I was obsessed, and that was the first instance of me actually listening to music, which, as you know, was groundbreaking. I loved Hatsune Miku so much that in my senior year of English class, the teacher told us to write a PowerPoint presentation about anything we wanted. Most kids talked about, like, ending racism or recycling or something like that, but I decided my presentation was gonna be about our girl, Hatsune Miku. You know, just as morally important as ending racism and preventing global warming. Of course, I disguised it as a presentation about, are hologram concerts gonna be the future of live music? But it was really just an excuse to gush about Miku because I desperately needed that outlet. I was a lonely child. Honestly, I'm not even sure how I mustered up the courage to do that presentation in the first place, because as the shy art girl who never talked to or hung out with anyone, it was a bold choice for me to talk about something considered so strange and nerdy at the time. I started my presentation and immediately was like, oh my god, what the hell am I doing talking about a holographic Japanese pop icon in front of my normie-ass classmates? I regret every moment I didn't stop myself from getting right here. After playing Miku's viral World is Mine performance for the class, one of the, like, popular girls was like, that was cool, can we watch another? And I thought she was making fun of me, so I just sat back down. As much as I loved Miku back then, my anxiety got the better of me, and I slowly drifted away from her because I didn't want to feel like a social outcast. It's a dog-eat-dog world when you're a teenager, and you know it. We were all just trying to survive out there. I'm sorry, Miku, I was weak. Fast forward to current Jaden. I've grown up a bit, and more sure of myself, learned some life lessons, am not surrounded by self-conscious teenagers 24/7. I'm now sitting here in front of my computer screen with a choice. Should I choose to yet again repress myself from pursuing a niche and uncommon interest because of self-conscious fears? Or am I gonna choose self-healing and growth and allow myself to fully re-explore the world of a Japanese virtual pop star to play DDR2? Crank up that Miku. I started downloading songs I listened to years ago, found some new ones, I was exploring and already getting more and more into the music I chose to leave behind out of fear years ago. I was flourishing. And that's how it began. I didn't know it back then, but this was the first step of a hyperfixation like no other I've experienced. Hatsune Miku was showing me the ways of truly enjoying music. I was playing her whenever I was in the car, consistently looking up new songs and artists to add to my playlist, even listening to her while I work or play video games, which I pretty much never did. My world was changing. And it was all hers. This wasn't just the music either, it was straight up about Hatsune Miku. I've never been a figure collector, but I started buying so many Miku figures I had to get a custom shelf in my office just to display them all. Dude, it's such a double-edged sword to be into Miku, because the fanbase is constantly being fed. New Miku this, new Miku that, gorgeous figures are coming out like every month. What am I supposed to do, not buy them? Every house needs to have at least one Miku. That's a feng shui rule.
Also, a huge oversight on my part. When I got my Miku shelf installed, I wanted it above my computer. It turned out great and displays them really well, but when I'm actually sitting at my desk and want to look up and admire my figures, all I see is accidental upskirt shots and I feel so bad. I'm sorry, Miku, I'm not trying to disrespect you, I promise. It was a miscalculation on my part. So whenever I'm at my desk, I just don't look up. As most of you probably know, Pokemon invited Jacob and me to Japan to attend the Pokemon World Championships back in August. That was super fun, and the video of that trip should be up by now if I'd planned things correctly. If not, then oops. But Worlds also just so happened to overlap with Magical Mirai, also known as one of the biggest Hatsune Miku expos and concerts ever. We had to go. Since getting super into Miku, it became one of my biggest dreams to see her live in concert. Who knows if we'd ever get this perfect of an opportunity again? What if she invites me backstage and we became friends? I immediately tried to get tickets, but couldn't figure out how the Japanese ticket system worked, so Emily ended up having to help me out. She was also the one who told me about the concert in the first place, so thank you, Emily, my hero, my savior. We got tickets. But not actually, because if you don't know, the way Japan does most of their online ticket systems is through a gacha. Yeah, random lottery. No matter how much money I was willing to hypothetically spend to get these tickets, at the end of the day, we were all just like those little numbered balls in that bingo spinner thing. Months pass as I eagerly await our fate. Then the email pops up in my inbox. I click it, scanning it way too quickly to understand any of the contents until my eyes catch it. Successfully obtained tickets. We're gonna see Miku! Suddenly, life had color again. This is what living feels like. Air tasted more pure. The sun was smiling, beaming even. I smiled back for the first time. Something smelled like toast. You have no idea how excited I was. I don't even understand why I love Hatsune Miku as much as I do, but she has become one of the pillars of my being. Let's jump to the day of the concert. Jacob and I are in Japan and are just about to arrive at the convention center. I remember looking out the window of the taxi, getting so excited to see people wearing their Miku shirts and kimonos, and they had Miku bags. I felt like I was finally around my people. We get there, walk into the convention center, and a blast of Hatsune Miku hits us. Giant Miku statues and posters, booths stocked with Miku merchandise, almost everyone dressed head to toe in Miku clothes. I saw people with Hatsune Miku suitcases to hold all the Miku things they were buying. I immediately wanted to run around and look at everything all at once. There were multiple times where Jacob lost me because I just started walking off in different directions like a Miku moth. We spent a few hours looking around and buying things. We spent a lot of money, but eventually we started getting ready for the live concert. I was giddy with excitement at this point. She was gonna be right in front of me. We found our seats and, dude, we were pretty damn close to the stage, especially for randomly selected seats. I couldn't believe how close we were gonna be to Hatsune Miku. I already knew going into it I was gonna cry frame one. If you didn't know, it's pretty standard to have special Miku glow sticks you can shake to the beat of whichever song is playing. You can even switch them to the coordinated color of whichever Vocaloid was on stage at the time. I've only learned about it from watching videos of concerts on YouTube thus far, and I gotta say, it was so fun to see people before the show warming up their arms and practicing their glow stick moves. They really take Hatsune Miku seriously, and I respect it so much. Some people were even quadruple wielding glow sticks. The record I personally saw was 6, like some sort of Miku Wolverine. It was a huge bummer though, because Jacob and I tried to buy some sticks of our own at the expo hall, but they were already sold out, so we didn't have any. And it was kind of embarrassing. Soon enough, the Miku songs the venue was playing started getting louder, and the house lights dimmed, and man, seeing the lights turn down, and the teal glow of all the sticks emanating together to light up the room, honestly, it made me tear up. I don't even think I realized how much I loved Hatsune Miku until that moment. Being completely surrounded by people who love her just as much and more than I do. This is what it's like to be into music, isn't it? To experience these moments being completely engulfed in a community, all connected by a single art. I get it now. It's beautiful.
The room glowed Miku blue, and everyone was cheering and shaking their glow sticks, anticipating her appearance. All the Vocaloids were introduced one by one with text on the hologram screen. Meiko, Luca, Kaito, Kagamina Rin, and Len. And then... Hatsune Miku. The crowd went ballistic. I could already feel myself holding back tears. A little digital poof explosion goes off, and there she was, right in front of us. She started singing, and Jacob and I were cheering and bouncing with the rest of the crowd. By the time she got a couple songs in, Jacob and I were definitely feeling left out for not having the glow sticks to shake, so we pulled out our Miku plushes to use in place of them, and that felt much better. By the end of the concert, Jacob was even dual-wielding Mikus. After a few songs, Miku disappeared, and the other Vocaloids played some of their songs. I honestly don't know them as well, so I wasn't too familiar with most of the songs they all played, but I was having a great time nonetheless. It was nice to not be fighting tears the whole time anymore as well. Then Miku came back and The concert continued on, and we learned some real nice glow stick moves, replaced with our Miku plushes, of course. There's the classic arm cheer on beat, the on beat off beat, the building cheer on to beat, even throw in the advanced building cheer on to double beat with a height. I'll say it, doing all those glow stick movements was honestly a really crazy arm workout. Like, we were working biceps and shoulders for 2 hours straight. Imagine Beat Saber, but higher up in the posture with almost no breaks. And if you don't commit, then Hatsune Miku thinks you hate her. I wanted to mention that in Vocaloid concerts, obviously they have a recording of the vocals because... you know. But all the other instruments were absolutely real. There was a live band playing all the songs for the entire set. In the middle of the concert, there was even a nice little appreciation moment showcasing all the band members by name, accompanied by a little solo they got to play. I'm a big bass fan and would love to learn how to play it one day, and I know bass players get super neglected because everyone wants to watch the cool guitar players, so I gave extra attention to the Miku bass player. They definitely noticed me cheering for them, probably because I could tell everyone was watching the guitar players and I was the only one actually looking at them. And the bass player smiled super wide and raised his bass to me. And I just thought that was a nice moment. Appreciate your bass players, guys. They need it. Anyway, the concert went on. There were awesome lasers and sparklers, fun costume changes from all the Vocaloids, great set list. Shout out to the guy in front of us that was there with his girlfriend and definitely more excited to be there than she was. Finally, it came to the encore. We had to convince Miku to play one more song. You know how, at least in America, people are cheering and screaming for an encore? Well, Japan is like so quiet and polite, they were saying it like a suggestion. It was so quiet, kind of just a long session of applause with a whisper of Miku. Miku. Like, if I were Hatsune Miku, I would have questioned if they even wanted the encore in the first place. Also, we were asking for the encore for like 5 minutes straight. I was fully convinced she had left the building. But she came out for her last song. It was a blast. She was in her magical Mirai outfit for the year. And it was over. I've only gone to one other concert in my entire life, and it was because a friend in college had an extra ticket and invited me along. I didn't even know the band at the time, it was some random group called Fallout Boy or something. But I could have been to 1,000 concerts and still say this was the best one I've ever been to. I loved the energy, I loved how passionate and excited everyone was to be there, and I loved Hatsune Miku, and still do. I want to go to so many more of her concerts. It was a great event for me, and I want to relive it again and again. You might think it's weird, or you don't get it. It's just a hologram robot girl, right? That's totally fine. If you can't find it in Vocaloid, I hope everyone has the opportunity to connect with or find a community to enjoy like I have with Hatsune Miku, because moments like that concert are so incredible and I feel so lucky to have been there. I just want everyone to experience something like that in their lifetime. Remember when Pokemon sent me every single one of their Gen 5 sitting cuties for me to rank? Turns out, they really liked that video. So much, in fact, that they said, "Hey Jaden, awesome video. Why don't you come to Japan to watch the Pokemon 2023 World Championships? Our treat! You won't have to pay for your flights or hotel or nothing."
I've been to Japan once before in my entire life, and it was back in 2018 with my family. We did a bunch of fun little Japanese tourist things. It was a phenomenal trip. But ever since then, I've always wanted to go back and do all the awesome nerdy stuff Japan has to offer that I didn't want to bother my family with. At the time, they didn't even know who Luffy was. They would have been so lost. So when Pokemon extended their hand and offered to fly not only me, but Jacob out to attend the biggest Pokemon tournament in the world, I jumped for joy. Free trip to Japan! The tournament was only going on for a single weekend, but Jacob and I planned to stay there for 3 whole weeks to do a bunch of said extra nerdy stuff. We were pumped. Eventually the time came, Jacob and I were packing up all our stuff, and decided we both would bring an extra suitcase so we could treat ourselves a bit and buy a bunch of cool stuff while we're there. Don't judge us, we're anime and Nintendo loving impulse buyers going to Japan. A game plan was needed. We were being responsible. 2 extra suitcases was definitely gonna be enough. Yep. Equipped with our extra luggage, we headed off to the airport. Pokemon straight up gave us business class seats. We didn't ask for them or anything. So when we boarded, we realized we had the seats where you could lay down. There even was some sort of seat divider that acted like a car window, so I could roll it down and bother Jacob whenever I wanted. Quick little 11-hour flight later, and we were in Japan. It was time to have the best trip of our lives. I'm not joking. I had the most incredible trip and got to do things I won't ever forget. And I won't, because I've now plastered it onto the internet forever. We landed midday Japan time, so we decided to go to the first thing we wanted to see while abroad. Japanese McDonald's. I couldn't order anything except fries, but Jacob and I both dropped our jaws when we saw something called the Double Big Mac on the menu. I thought Americans already went big with the Big Mac, but Japan did the impossible. Just to send a message. What a magical place. Let's begin with the next morning. Pokemon planned a bunch of cool stuff for the creators and partners they flew out, beginning with a group field trip to the Mega Tokyo Pokemon Center. Jacob and I woke up early for it and missed the bus they had for us. And it totally wasn't completely my fault entirely because I hypothetically didn't read the schedule correctly and was taking my sweet time getting ready. Why would you think that? So we had to take the trains on our own to get there. Anyone that remembers my first Japan trip knows the trains were me and my family's mortal enemy number one. We kept getting it wrong and it was failure after failure the entire trip. You'd think that with all that prior experience and struggle, I would have grown as a Japanese train understander, right? Nope, we got on the wrong train. But at least we were having a good time. After a lot of freaking out and mental strain and regrets, we finally arrived at our destination, and although by the time we got there they had already finished looking at the Pokemon Center, we were able to grab a quick snack with the group at the Pokemon Sweets Cafe. I meant to take a picture of the Pikachu waffle before I ate half its cranium, but I forgot, so this is what you get. Now that we were with the group, we were able to travel with them for the rest of the day, so we packed into the bus and headed off to a traditional tea ceremony where we were taught all about how the tea masters would make tea and tea etiquette and all these things about the significance of tea in Japanese culture, all while getting to taste the tea master made. Again, I meant to take this picture before I took a chunk out of the little sweet they gave us, but here we are yet again. I'm just not that great at this. They also served us a really special lunch of super fancy bento boxes. Like, so fancy that the host was like, dude, I've never even had these bento boxes before. I was super excited, but I don't mean to be ungrateful or wasteful, but the box was full of super fancy, complicated fish and seafood. I knew going to Japan, I'd have to be flexible with food because it's really hard to be vegan or even vegetarian there, so I really tried to eat as much as possible and look thankful. But yeah, I struggled a lot. But I still had a great time and it was an honor. We were dropped off at the Yokohama Chinatown and left to explore a bit until dinner in a few hours. Everyone separated into groups and Jacob, Stefan, the guy that sent me all the sitting cuties, you guys remember him, the guy named Steve and I went and pursued the street food a bit before stumbling into a little arcade with a bunch of crane machines. I got this silly little bear minifigure. His name is Chikoob, so I decided to innocently carry him around in my pocket for the entirety of the trip. You know, because he was silly. This single action severely changed the course of my mental stability going forward. You'll see soon enough. But look at these cute photos I got with him. We had a great dinner, headed back to the hotel, got to hang out with our good old Pokemon rival Jit. Or yawn a bit, and called it a night. The next day, we all got to do some private shopping at the Pokemon World's pop-up shop. I'll just say we bought way too much stuff that we also don't regret in the slightest. I even got this video of Jacob grabbing more and more sitting cuties as the workers kept reorganizing them to keep the display looking perfect. We walked out of there with 3 giant bags of stuff. But it's okay, because remember, we anticipated this with our extra suitcases, which I am starting to wonder if they are gonna be enough, but surely we will come down. We were then all taken to the creature's offices. You know, just the place where they make Pokemon cards. It was gorgeous in there. They had these awesome sculptures of giant Pokemon cards with crystals, and all the walls were lined with 3D card art. It felt like I was in a building with a lot of significance. Because I was. We got a tour around the building, met the TCG card testers, and were able to ask them questions about their process. Even got to have a little Q&A session with Atsushi Nagashima, the game director of the Pokemon TCG. It was funny, one of the people in our group asked how they chose which Pokemon to make cards for. A good question. And then followed it up with, I really like Mantyke, but there's only 2 Mantyke cards that exist. And the assistant pulled up a list of all the Pokemon Mantyke cards that have ever been created, and sure enough, there were only 2. The director chuckled and was essentially like, yeah, sometimes Pokemon get lost in the cracks. We kinda just make cards of Pokemon I like. For example, my favorite Pokemon is Gengar. And you know what? That actually makes a lot of sense. Also, we were able to have a Q&A session with the Pokemon card art director and 3 artists who actually draw art for the cards. That was super interesting, and I was so incredibly inspired by that discussion. But you know those Pokemon cards with the super cute clay art? That artist's name is Yuka Mori, and she was in that panel. I was so starstruck. Those are some of my favorite Pokemon cards. And not only that, but she hosted a little workshop for us where she gave us clay and taught us how to make little clay Magnemites like in this card here. Speaking of this card, she brought the actual original Magnemite for us to see. That was by far the coolest thing that I've ever gotten to be a part of. We got to meet a piece of genuine history. I felt like I was meeting the president. Also, here's me and Jacob's Magnemites that we made. Day 3 of our little Pokemon field trip, and we were taken to another Pokemon Center, this time in Shibuya, which was also right across from a Nintendo store. It was like a bullet was shot through our credit cards. In the shopping center, I saw a little gacha machine with little miniature Chikoa plushes. I was only interested in getting Chikoa, but I decided to test my luck anyway. And I got him first try! Now I had 2 of them. Yes, the original was still in my pocket. You can safely assume he is in my pocket for the entirety of this video. I've got pictures to prove it. Jacob snapped this awesome picture of the Chikoa brain rot taking over. When we were looking around in the Shonen Jump shop, a little Japanese boy pointed at Jacob and went, Sanji-san, before his mother quickly yanked him away, and I still to this day laugh at that interaction. Poor kid saw his first blonde guy in real life and immediately thought it was Sanji. Later that day, we also got to attend the Pokemon Symphony, where a live orchestra played Pokemon songs, and it was absolutely incredible. Video game orchestras are so cool. It always tugs on my heartstrings to see video game music transformed into such a beautiful new art form. Highly recommend attending one if you have any favorite games or franchises. On to the first day of Worlds. It was exciting, people flooded into the venue, we watched the opening ceremony in the crowd. Just wow. This is the whole reason why we're here. We went back to shopping. Look at this cute little Chikoa book I found in a nearby bookstore. At this point, we were absolutely pushing it in terms of luggage space, and we were day 4 into a 2.5-week trip. Our shopping sprees until this point were very not frugal, so we cut our losses and bought 2 extra giant suitcases to fit everything better. Okay, we knew we were gonna need extra suitcases. Getting a few extra couldn't hurt. Look, the flights were paid for. We were still saving money at this point, I think. That's my rationalization. I'm going with that. Also in the mall were tons of Pokemon monitors straight up playing the World Championships. TCG, Pokemon Go, VGC. Japan treated Worlds like it was the Super Bowl. And it was just so cool to see one of my main interests so culturally celebrated. People of all ages would stop by to watch for a bit before going back to their shopping. I can't explain it, but it just made me very happy. We even got to see Wolfie live on the monitors. How'd he do? He did great. Don't worry about it. Nothing happened. Look, we were just happy to see our friend on the Pokeball screen. Proud of you, Wolfie. You're so cool. The second day of Worlds was hype. So hype that we left Yokohama and flew to Osaka. I haven't mentioned it yet, but we actually got tickets to see the one and only Hatsune Miku live in concert. The real ones know how huge that is for me. I want to talk about how life-changing that was, but I'm going to make a whole separate video about that experience I'll be posting next. All I'm going to say is it was the best day of my entire life. By a lot. Subscribe now before you miss it, just saying. I will mention, we did have to take the train to get back later that night, and got super lost again. And we never get better at it. Don't expect anything to change in that regard. We did finally get back to Yokohama, crashed for the night, and had a nice slow morning as we got ready for finals later that day. To any One Piece fans who are caught up, we were in Japan for the One Piece anime episode. You know what I'm talking about. 1072. We were able to turn on our hotel TV and watch it live. And that was so cool. I don't talk about how much I love One Piece much, mainly because it doesn't really come up. But One Piece is peak, and it was an honor to be in Japan at such an iconic part of the manga and anime's history. Anyway, back to Pokemon, sorry about that. We were able to watch the final VGC match live, got to chat and eat dinner with Wolfie and some other friends, had a late night hangout with Yan again, and that was about it. Day 7 meant it was time to pack up all our stuff from the hotel, say goodbye to Pokemon and Yokohama, and head on over to the apartment we rented for the rest of our stay just outside of Tokyo. At this point, we had filled up all 6 suitcases and multiple backpacks. I didn't mention it, but Pokemon gave us a truckload of gifts that we genuinely had no idea what to do with. We're grateful nonetheless, thank you Pokemon. But yeah, the taxi ride was a bit awkward. So, are you meeting up with some friends? No. After we got situated in the new place, we decided to look around the area and grab some lunch. And I gotta say, the little hole-in-the-wall restaurant Jacob found was some of the best ramen I've ever had, ever. They even made it vegetarian for me, which was extremely kind of them. Food modifying is a bit tricky in Japan compared to the States, so I was very, very thankful. And it was delicious! We then proceeded to do absolutely nothing for the rest of the day because we were exhausted from the trip so far. I haven't mentioned absolutely everything we'd been doing on the trip because it would be a lot of, first we did this and it was cool, then we did this and it was cool. Even though it was such a pleasure to be invited, I was so dead and definitely looked super not approachable or friendly to the rest of the group by the end of it. Sorry, guys. But neither time nor Japan stops for anyone, so we had to keep on chugging along. There were a bunch of friends we wanted to see while in Japan, and one of them was Connor. He wanted to take us to what he deemed his favorite Italian place ever. I asked if it was like fancy Italian, to which I was given the answer of no. So we get there, having a great time, and suddenly we realize Junichi Masuda, the director of Game Freak, is there having dinner. Not a fancy dinner, my ass! I then look down to see the Freddy Fazbear FNAF t-shirt that I am wearing. Not the best Jane moment to exist, but hey, what can you do? The food was phenomenal, though. I already mentioned the best ramen I've ever had while on the trip, but this was genuinely the best pasta I've ever had in my entire life. Maybe even a top 3 meals ever for me. I don't know what the other two would be, but that Connor place is definitely up there. The next day, we went to the One Piece store in Shibuya and bought a lot of stuff because there was a lot of topical and hype things in there, as you could imagine. If you don't get it, go catch up and come back. Don't worry, it won't take too long. My favorite character is Mihawk, but out of all the stuff the store had to offer, there were only a few stickers and a single keychain from Mihawk. I'm still mauling about that one. I just want more Mihawk. Is that too much to ask for? Even this guy got better merch. The world's greatest swordsman deserves better. I guess I'll just take my Zoro and Law stuff. That's cool too, I suppose. I also found a bunch of Chikawa stuff in a Kittyland store, and this is truly when you get to see where things start going downhill for me. I just like the funny little cartoon bear thing. What? Is that such a crime? I don't remember what we did the rest of the day. I think we just crashed and passed out. This trip, as surreal as it's been so far, has been absolutely taking a toll on me, and I desperately needed to just not move or talk or exist for a bit. We were doing so many different things that were all awesome, and hanging out with so many different people that were all awesome, but man, I am not built for extended periods of that much excitement and socializing. As much as I would like to change this fact, I'm also not a very active person. I know. Up until this trip, I was practically sitting down 24/7, working all the time to prep as much work as possible so I could have a guilt-free 3 weeks off, and my muscles were definitely starting to decay at that point. I looked at my phone's step meter thing, and there was one day where I literally got 300 steps. That's pathetic. And suddenly, I'm logging over 20,000 daily. My body was screaming. What the hell are you doing out there? Please stop. Plus, we were in Japan during the hottest, most humid time of the year. Every time we left the air-conditioned luxury of a building, we would immediately be drenched in sweat. Look, I'm used to the heat. I grew up in Arizona, but even this was too much. So yeah, crash and burn it was. Tokyo Disneyland was a bit underwhelming. It felt like a slightly worse version of the one in California because of the oddly spaced layout and surprisingly empty vibe. We did go to a Stitch-themed show thing, and as we were walking in, a worker stopped us and said, "Oh, excuse me, Stitch only speaks Japanese," like warning us it's not super tourist friendly. But I just think the statement of "Stitch only speaks Japanese" is hilarious. We went in anyway, and yep, Stitch only spoke Japanese. Kazoku. Yeah, overall, it was not the best thing we did, but apparently, I didn't know this, Japan has two Disneys, Disneyland and DisneySea. And we went to Land, which is unanimously deemed the worst of the two. So, oops, better luck next time. Jacob and I took two more rest days where we just turned to ash. Then up and at 'em, back to Osaka we go. This time, we went to an Eve concert. Besides Hatsune Miku, the Japanese band Eve is the only other concert I've said I wanted to go see. I love their music videos they have for all their songs. It's always such beautiful animation. And by the way, they're the ones who sang the Season 1 Jujutsu Kaisen anime opening theme, if you're lost. Earlier in the trip, Jacob just so happened to look up if they were doing a concert while we were there, and lo and behold, they were. He got some totally not scalped tickets, which turned out to be a super complicated process, so thank you, Jacob. You're the bestest friend I've ever had. Thank you for going through the trenches for silly old me. Anyway, the concert was so incredible. The atmosphere was fantastic. They had awesome visual effects going on. The glow bands a lot of people bought were perfectly synced to the music and colors on the stage, which really enhanced the experience. The music was great, which, I mean, of course it was. That was the whole reason we went in the first place. I talk about it more in the upcoming Miku video, but Japanese encores are so much different from the American ones. They're so quiet and polite. There is pretty much no screaming and cheering. It was just a long applause with a semi-whisper chant of "Encore! Encore!" And they also made us wait like 5 minutes for them to come back out. My hands were getting itchy just from clapping so much, that's how long it took. And then when they finally came out, they ended up doing like 5 extra songs. I mean, I'm not complaining, but after the 4th time thinking, man, that was a great last extra song. Well, time to head home. Wait. Another? It starts getting a bit comedic. This is just a side tangent, but Jacob went off to use the bathroom before the show started and came back 10 minutes later like, dude, this is crazy, but it took me a bit longer to find a bathroom because there were so many extra women's bathrooms, which is like, whoa, that's actually so smart. There's always such a huge line for the women's bathroom compared to the men's in any scenario. I was just shocked Japan was like, okay, then we'll make more women's bathrooms to fix that problem. Like, it was so simple. I know in America it would probably turn into a stupid political thing, but it made me so happy Japan just implemented such an obvious and straightforward solution so easily for the gals. The next day, we headed over to Universal, which was hands down the best amusement park I've ever been to. So they can do amusement parks well. First of all, Universal Japan is way more anime and manga focused than the ones in the States, which made it instantly more engaging for me. Jacob and I both agreed we would window shop for the first part of the day, and then buy all the things we wanted as we were leaving so we wouldn't have to lug around a bunch of bags all day. But we immediately saw a little One Piece shop and cracked. We just wanted to wear these One Piece headbands, that's rule-breaking worthy. We also got some towels because surprise, surprise, surprise. It was freaking hot. I know I've been complaining about the weather here and there, but my lord, it was miserably scorching. Japan has such a big culture around staying cool while outside, and I totally get it now. People would be walking around with little fans, ice packs, towels. A lot of women had parasols. I'll say, if we didn't get those towels, we probably could have passed out from heat stroke that day. Later on, I even ended up getting another towel. It was a cute Pikachu one, but I got it mainly because it was a cloak design. After soaking that thing in cold water and putting it on, my body temperature instantly lowered like 5 degrees. However, that meant I was walking around the park looking like this. Back to the awesome stuff. We did a bunch of attractions like watch a fun 4D Jujutsu Kaisen show where the seats move around, went on a super cool 3D VR Spider-Man ride. We tried to cool down by going on a Minions thing called Freeze Ray Sliders that claimed to cool riders down with a blast of chilled mist from a giant freeze ray. But we got on and absolutely did not even touch a drop of the mist because it never ended up getting in range of our cart. That felt like an actual tragedy at the time. There were a few big roller coasters we wanted to go on, but I get super motion sick and forgot to bring nausea medicine, so no roller coasters for us. But I shall return one day. The park, of course, had a bunch of cool themed restaurants, one of them being a super cool One Piece restaurant. Did I mention I like One Piece? There also was a special Sanji one, but we didn't know you needed a reservation, so... fooey. It was awesome though, I love One Piece. After a few hours of rides and being broiled alive, we decided to fully cool off by going on the Jurassic Park ride that's just giant Splash Mountain with dinosaurs. We cooked in line for probably a solid hour, and as soon as we were literally stepping foot inside the ride, it started pouring rain. Now that's just not fair. I don't even understand how that happened, but... whatever. We started buying all the stuff we window shopped for as we waited for the One Piece live show to begin. Again, please refrain from judging. I am being vulnerable and open here. By the way, as we were walking around, we stumbled onto a little Mario-themed show just out in a courtyard area. They played some fun little custom songs and had all these dancers alongside the mascots. And then out of nowhere, they started absolutely blasting the crowd with like gallons of water. I didn't even see it coming. It was like firefighters showed up to put out a giant fire, except the fire was a bunch of Japanese people. The time came and we got to file in for the special One Piece live show, and even though Jacob and I didn't understand a single part of it because it was all in Japanese, it was awesome, and the costume design was phenomenal. It was a bit unfortunate though, because the seats were all in like a half circle formation around the stage. As much as they tried to make the show enjoyable from all angles, it was pretty hard to see the main things going on in the center. My only true complaint though is that Zoro didn't come to our side at all. All the other characters rotated around so we could see them, but Zoro only did it at the very end to take a bow. Also, Mihawk being included would have been nice, but it's okay. By the time we got to enter Nintendo Land, it was like 9 p.m. We got up at 6 a.m., by the way, so we pretty much just rode the Yoshi's Island ride they don't have in the States and headed home because that's all the energy we had left. But even just seeing that, it was miles better than the one in the States. Also, we picked up a little dinner at the 7-Eleven near our hotel. 7-Eleven is actually awesome in Japan, by the way. And they had a few little Chikoa plushie keychains, and I bought them. Just being transparent here. We woke up early the next morning to catch our flight back to Tokyo and hurried over to the Kirby Cafe. Emily actually booked the reservation for us. She was meant to also be there, but she was only able to get 2 seats and gave them to us as a gift. Emily, I will always be indebted to you for your sacrifice. The cafe itself was so well decorated with all these little Kirby things, and the menu was adorable. I got the Star Curry and a magical little fruity drink with a Kirby marshmallow that triggered my cute aggression. Jacob got the pizza and a Kirby burger, but since he made modifications, the staff asked him to not post a picture of the burger to the public. Like, they didn't know he was a content creator or anything. I guess they just didn't want the public to see a naked Kirby burger. We also both got desserts. I already decided I was gonna consume the Kirby. The presentation was beautiful. It was literal art on a plate. Taste-wise, it was decent. The body was some sort of gelatin, which I wasn't too crazy about, but the rest was super tasty. I did my best, but he ended up looking like he was in a horrific accident when I threw in the towel. The cafe also has a special little private store connected to it. And yeah, what you expect happened definitely happened. We left with full bellies and bags, continued to look around the shopping center the cafe was connected to, and ended up walking into a gacha store. I am about to be very vulnerable with you here. This is one of the lowest points of my entire life. Please don't think too much less of me after what happened in that gacha store. So I walk in, spot Chikawa, beeline it to the machine, obviously. Like I mentioned before, I'm only interested in Chikawa, so I was only playing for him. But by the cursed luck of the gacha gods, I just could not get him. I was going back and forth between the machine and the coin exchange, getting multiples of every other little guy, but no Chikawa. I could feel the workers' glances at me, probably because the desk they were standing behind was right next to the machine I was grinding. But after way too much money, he dropped. I got my well-earned, horribly priced at that point, Chikawa. I then started looking at all the other machines, putting some coins in a few here and there, until I stopped at one that had a line of animals playing band instruments. They were very silly, but there was a little pigeon holding up cymbals, and I really wanted to get him for Jordan and Kelsey. In went the coins. Tiger, elephant, fox. It was happening again. Everything except the one I wanted. Which, I know more or less that's the luck with gachas, but it was getting to the point where I was getting surprised the pigeon was dodging me as much as it was. Surely the next one, what? Eventually, I had to go back to the coin exchange, and as I was about to put in more money, I saw out of the corner of my eye one of the workers peek out and take a look in horror at all the gachapons that were sitting at the top of my bag. They then raised up their hand and said something in Japanese while shaking their head, and I knew in my heart I was being cut off. No, please! I can stop whenever, just a few more hits and I'm done! The pigeon is next, I can feel it. Why do you look afraid? What's under the desk? I got kicked out of a gacha store! I had hit an all-time low. I told my friends and they said they probably just thought I was gonna try and resell them, but I don't even know if that would even make it sound better knowing I was getting so many that they thought I was robbing them blind. I just wanted my little Chikawa and pigeon with cymbals. We made dinner plans that night with a friend and we were just about to grab a taxi and head back to freshen up, but Jacob and I caught sight of a fun anime and goodies shop. Who do we think we are? People with self-control? We'll make it quick! We rushed in and split up for optimization. As I was looking around, I saw it. A whole section dedicated to Chikawa. It was like someone put a freshly baked pie on a windowsill, and I was suddenly floating over to it. My eyes were zoned in, making sure I saw every single thing possible, putting Chikawa after Chikawa in the basket. Jacob eventually came over and showed me a picture he took on his phone. In my tunnel vision, all my eyes registered was that the picture showed more Chikawa in the store. I immediately went feral. Where? Jacob's eyebrows went up in surprise and maybe a bit of fear. And as I looked at the photo again, I realized Jacob wasn't showing me a picture of a different Chikawa section. He was showing me a picture of me at the current Chikawa section I was standing in because he thought it was funny. And in my Chikawa brain rot, I didn't even register I was in the picture. I just saw more Chikawa and went obsessive. This is how I am. Either stand by me or leave. No, I don't need an intervention. Put it away. We left. I looked longingly at the crane machine Chikawas we didn't have time for, and we made it in time for dinner. Plus, we ended up in another arcade nearby anyway, and I got myself a Chikawa from one of those machines, so it worked out. Stop. I don't want to hear it. Finally, we were reaching the end of our trip. We spent the last day grabbing lunch with Emily and Didus. There was a cool One Piece scavenger hunt event going on, so we also did that with them. We basically had to walk around Shibuya and find special One Piece trading card posters hidden around the area. And if we found enough along with the special card of the day, we could get a limited edition mystery card. It was fun, but also hot. And all my clothes were sticking to my body. Didus generously let me borrow his umbrella, and I jumped for joy as he showed me it was coincidentally Chikawa themed. I don't know what's wrong with me. All I know is that bear makes me happy. We spent a few hours completing the scavenger hunt, got our special cards, and bid them farewell. Always good to see you guys. Bye-bye! I accidentally stole Didus' umbrella. It looked so calculated. They knew how much I was obsessed with Chikawa. They'd been watching my Instagram stories. Follow if you want to see brain rot in real time. Emily, I have the Chikawa umbrella. I didn't mean to steal it, I promise. It's not what it looks like.
since we were leaving in the morning and wouldn't be seeing them again, they just let me keep it. But the side eye Jacob gave me the rest of the way back. I didn't mean to- Stop it!
Getting back to the apartment, reality hit us hard. We needed just a few more suitcases. Again. In total, we ended up buying 6 extra suitcases to hold everything we collectively bought. And even then, it was a struggle making it fit. Jacob ended up going professional Tetris mode, perfectly fitting everything into the suitcases with quite literally no extra room to spare. We came to Japan each with a backpack, carry-on, and 1 extra big suitcase, and we're leaving with altogether 8 suitcases and 4 backpacks. We were lucky the taxi driver had a big enough car to fit everything because we didn't have much of a game plan if it didn't. Off to the airport we went, where we checked all of our excessive bags, paid a couple fees, boarded our flight, and headed home. That trip will go down as one of the best trips I've ever gone on. It felt like it turned into a celebration of everything that makes me me. All of my hobbies and interests, Pokemon, One Piece, at the last minute, Chikoa. We got to do so many incredible things and were given so many opportunities I'd never even thought I could be a part of. I got to see so many friends that are normally so far away, ate some of the best meals of my life, and overall was just really happy, especially getting to spend it all with my best friend, Jacob. By the way, if you wanted to know why in the world we got so many things, yes, a lot of it was for us. 90% of it all was for our friends. 100% of the Chikoa stuff was mine, but that's besides the point. If you want to see what we got them, also credit where credit is due, the majority of it all was from Jacob, because he's a great gift giver and even more incredible friend to the people around him. We're all nothing short of lucky to be able to call him our friend. You can go watch his Japan video. I assume it's already up, because we had to animate a freaking 30-minute long video. My god, it was a lot. Thanks for sticking around. But yeah, I just had an unforgettable trip, and I owe the opportunity to the Pokemon Company for inviting us to Japan in the first place. I'm extremely lucky to be in the position I am, and will be forever grateful. Back in April, Chikoa started teasing their newest project, Chikoa Park. Despite them not revealing any follow-up details at all, I was obviously frothing at the mouth. Over the next few months, information slowly started being unveiled, until finally, teaser photos.
Oh my god. Chikoa is real. I had to figure out how to go.
But to anyone who knows how Japan works, you'd understand this is a much more difficult mission to accomplish than suggested, because practically everything is executed through randomized lotteries. You can't just camp a website and refresh 5 times a second in hopes of being the first to buy all the tickets to resell, like the barbaric ways of the West. You apply alongside 100,000,000,000 people, then pray on your hands and knees to the gacha overlords, knowing you ultimately have no power in this world whatsoever. I lit my manifestation candles and let the overlords choose my fate when I secured tickets. Chikoa, thank you for shining your light down on me. I figured since I'm gonna be flying all the way back to Japan for the park, I might as well spend my time as surrounded by Chikoa as I can. So I ended up turning it into the most jam-packed Chikoa-themed trip I possibly could. Sarah, good friend and fellow Chikoa enjoyer, and I hopped on a plane and sped off to Tokyo to experience possibly the most obsessive yet exciting time of our lives. After landing, sleeping, and waking up bright and early, I was practically buzzing with excitement, knowing today was the day I was going to witness the most anticipated Chikoa event the franchise has created yet. Equipped to live through the most memorable day of my life, we headed off to the park. As we were driving, my head was still buzzing with questions about what the event was even gonna be like. The promotion of the whole thing had been super secretive. I really didn't know what to expect going into it. The car pulled up, and we were greeted by giant Chikoa and friends wrapped around the building. This is how I knew it was gonna be huge. Please prepare yourself. We walked through a very hypnotizing Chikoa portal that opened up to the welcoming first room. You could sit in Rako's car, see Shisa and Ramen Yoroi-san chatting together, and even spot a cheeky little Momonga and Furuhonya. Also, naturally, there is a huge wall of Chikoa hats and headbands for purchase right out the gate, so you could walk around sporting your Chikoa Oshi. I will say they went all out on the character headband selection. Almost every single guy in the series was there, including the random enemies. As someone who tends to like super obscure side characters in series, it warmed my heart. Deeper into the room, you can find a real-life replica of Chikoa's actual home. Please don't disturb them too much, though. They're very busy studying for their reading exam. Good luck, Chikoa. I know you can do it this time, buddy. What was super cool was the specialized little photo booths they had. You and a friend, or if you're a lone wolf Chikoa enjoyer, that's cool too, sit down at one of the logs and are given the option to take a photo with either Chikoa, Hachiware, or Usagi. Whichever character you choose pops out to join your photo with their own personalized animation, which was such a wonderfully cute attention to detail. Sarah and I both freaked out when a shy little Chikoa shuffled its way over to us, and everyone in the room watched as we took photo after photo after photo, squealing at every single one. Walking by, we encountered a helpless Hachiware stuck in a ditch. Besides sitting there with him while he yelled for help, there was unfortunately nothing we could do for this poor fella as we stared at our own pitiful reflections above us. Knowing they recreated and built a part of the manga that made me cry gave me a very strange mixture of bittersweet feelings, but ultimately it was too cute to fully question the morality of it. To continue into the next section, you have to wander your way through the discombobulating mirror maze of the nightmare-inducing elephant. The lights were flashing various colors, the floor and walls were painted all sorts of disorienting patterns, everything was super wiggly, and I may or may not have crashed into a couple mirrors, who's to say. Sarah and I stumbled out of the very humbling maze eventually, but as staff came over and gave us Chikoa-themed 3D glasses, we realized we weren't safe yet, as there were multiple screens of various enemies hacking and slashing and Kalfat spitting in our direction. You really don't realize how many evil, treacherous creatures there are in this series until you sit in front of every single one as they try to get you. In fact, I'm realizing now a lot of the experiences Chikoa Park puts you through are the evil, messed up, life-threatening parts. True Chikoa fans know the series isn't all sunshine and rainbows like you'd expect looking at it from the outside, but that is the part about Chikoa that I love the most. Even in the most wholesome of lands where there can be giant rivers of miso soup, meadows of plants bearing toasted buns, and friendly neighbors that just want to buy cute pajamas, you can still get hit with 8 whole days being kidnapped, starved, and thrown in goblin jail for eating the wrong stupid-ass mushroom. Such is life. Don't stress too much, though. As you can see, things find a way of working out as the giant cyclops Ode thrashes his way through the goblins at true scale. I really liked this section. After you all nearly escape being eaten by goblins, you're led into the shelter of a nearby temple. Chikoa and Hachiware bear curious looks, innocently wondering what could await them ahead. And as you pull back the curtain of the next room, it's the evil, dark, and twisted snake that curses everyone with eternal yearning for the mines, already amassing an endless hallway of brainwashed civilians. Which masochist on the design team pitched this one? Who was it? No, they even have crystallized Usagi. There's a tried and true hater amongst the Chikoa Park designers, and honestly, they deserve a raise. As you try to hurry your way out of the temple, Hachiware is seen having to unsheathe his tiny claws in self-defense of a guard. Up ahead, Chikoa hides behind a mirror as the snake tries to zap them with his crystallizing gaze. It's implied the beam reflects off the mirror and kills the snake, but they don't specifically show it. Yeah, I suppose we should draw the line at actual death in the silly little Chikoa Park experience. Everyone is busted up and bruised, but finally free to leave the malevolent temple. What lies past these doors? Well, with the craziest luck, we happened to be there as Chikawa and Momonga were out that day to greet people. I almost crumpled to the floor right then and there in front of every single employee. Hi, Momonga. I'm a big fan. Don't listen to what the people are saying about you on the internet. They were so cute and energetic, and they even had Chikawa Park headbands of their own favorite or related characters. Any knowers? After many, many photos with our fave, I don't care if you hate him, you can pry Momonga away from my cold dead fingers. We were led upstairs to the second floor of the park, and as we ascended, my jaw was left behind. The entire second floor of Chikawa Park was completely dedicated to custom, exclusive, never-before-seen Chikawa merchandise. Which, yes, does imply the full story of the walkthrough experience on the first floor is you living peacefully in the world of Chikawa, getting trapped in an inconceivable nightmare maze, somehow escaping only to find yourself being jumped by every violent creature within a 10-mile radius, being thrown in goblin jail, breaking out and running away to a nearby temple, finding yourself surrounded by enslaved creatures controlled against their will to do grueling manual labor for eternity by an evil snake that crystallizes one of your best friends, watching poor anxious Chikawa pushed to kill in order to release the curse, and everyone escaping within an inch of their lives. I literally could not have written it better myself. That is quite literally the best representation of the series you could possibly present. And as a treat for getting through all of it, you can now spend all of your money. To say it was overwhelming, it is an understatement. There were 5 whole organized areas for shopping and merch. The Chikawa section had big plushies, small plushies, keychain plushies, plushie slap bracelets. The characters came in any size, shape, or form you wanted, and it was very pleasing on the eyes, might I say. Hachiwate's area was more centered around decorative items and collectibles. Pens, necklaces, notebooks, tote bags, more keychains of quite literally every character in the series. Household items like plates, glasses, utensils, this really funny soap dispenser based on Chikawa getting a parasite. Over in Usagi's shop, they had apparel, lots of cute shirts, jackets, socks, and literally my favorite item of the entire store, the character backpacks. They're the perfect size, so freaking cute, and you can show off more of your plushies in the front pocket. Yes, I got the Momonga one. You'll have to kill me to silence my truth. Across the floor was a themed area for popcorn, cookies, various other snacks, but the part that stopped Sarah and I in our tracks was this custom keychain maker section. There were so many charm options, letters, shapes, characters, references. Sarah and I spent like 15 minutes sitting on the floor together trying to figure out what we even wanted to make. There were too many possibilities. This was probably a lot to digest all at once. So to take a little breather, we can play the little carnival games around the corner. Meatball Korogashi is simple. Roll meatballs down the chute to try and get it in the skee ball hole. You get a trial roll, which Sarah and I both sunk, and then 3 real meatball rolls, which Sarah and I both utterly failed. In the other game, Kimono Catcher, you had to fling the butterfly-ified Chikawa, Hachiwate, and Usagi into spider webs. Kinda messed up, but look, I'm here to win! I didn't get a single one in the net. I was just trying to keep them safe! Sarah actually got one in and won a giant Chikawa pillow. Questionable morality yet again being presented in this twisted establishment, but god, it's a good pillow. Chikawa Park is such a wonderful celebration of the franchise, and I'm so happy it's been successful enough to earn such a grand building and experience. There are so many little details crafted with love and dedication that any Chikawa fan would appreciate, and the inclusive of all the characters means there's something for fans of any creature. Yes, even that evil goddamn star that I want to splat with a fly swatter. Alright, well, that's, why are you... You're looking at me a little funny.
I don't know what you want from... Okay, yes, we got a shit ton of merchandise. Everyone watched as Sarah and I frolicked around the merch floor, quite literally like Jaden in a Chikoa shop. It took like 15 minutes for the employees to ring up each of our halls. Everyone was happy for us and encouraged us to get things, but Sarah and I couldn't help but visibly succumb to the shame. With what broken Japanese I knew, I tried to make conversation with the clerks while we waited. Sumimasen. Chikoa daisuki. Hazukashi. If you're wanting to see the Chikoa Park Hall, you're getting a bit ahead of yourself because you might have forgotten we still have more Chikoa locations to go to. There's more. So much more to add to the final haul. Next up was the Chikoa Ramen Shop. The theming of everything was so fun. It was just like a little Japanese ramen spot with all the characters designed to look like they were employees. And even the glasses and bowls were specifically designed to match the atmosphere. Sarah ordered a momonga soda, which looked like she enjoyed. And I couldn't help myself from ordering a kurumanju beer. Yes, it was noon. Yes, I don't really like beer. And yes, I get drunk way too easily. But I simply could not pass up the opportunity to have a taste of Kurumanju's iconic favorite beverage. While I very carefully sipped on my breakfast, the staple and only food option of the restaurant arrived. The Chikoa Ramen. Since it has pork in it, I unfortunately chose to abstain. Sarah got to eat it though and said it was delicious, so I believe her on that one too. Also, I think I'm drunk now. Luckily, the next stop was right across from us as we walked directly into the Chikoa Cafe. And thank the Lord because I needed something other than alcohol in my stomach. Sarah and I were fawning over the menu because not only was there more variety, but everything was so cute. Momonga Furuhonya jelly beverage, Chikoa yogurt drink, Hachiwara and egg blanket plate, spicy Chikoa curry, Usagi flan, Momonga parfait, interactable Chikoa weeding tiramisu. Look at this menu, you guys! Humanity has peaked! We took turns tasting everything, and it was surprisingly all pretty good. Nothing was bland, none of the desserts were too sweet. I've seen some comments that the curry was a bit too spicy, but honestly, I respect the cafe's commitment to an actually higher than average spiciness, especially when it's colored bright red. By the way, the special cafe collectibles were so cute. Everyone had a little cafe uniform on, and oh... Since we'd finished up our meals, we hit up the Chikoa store in the Tokyo Station Character Street, as well as the Chikoa Land shop in Shinjuku, which were both simpler, but still very great for general shopping. We were very meticulous to go through and appreciate every section of every aisle, so even though they can be seen comparatively as just, you know, typical shops, you can imagine we spent lots of time there too. You know, despite us going to so many Chikoa locations, nothing ever felt repetitive. Even with the small little shops, Chikoa is somehow just so incredibly locked in on making great merch. I don't know how in the world they do it. Plus, they're constantly spitting out more and more. I thought getting into Miku was awful for my wallet, but I'm sorry, Chikoa. I didn't clock how much skin you had in the game. Alright, so the next place we were headed to was the one Sarah and I were the most excited for. Obviously, besides the park. The Chikoa Bakery. And it absolutely did not disappoint. The design of the shop was divine, from the colors to the decorative characters, all the way down to the actual baked goods. Oh, it was like nothing we'd seen before. And at this point, we had seen a lot of Chikoa, so you can imagine how much weight that statement has. The treats looked so beautiful inside the display, and there were a ton more options than I was expecting. Everything was, of course, really good. I really liked the matcha momonga croissant, but I thought the kurumanju red bean bun was the funniest little guy because it just looks exactly like him. I have consumed his beer, and now I have consumed him. Admittedly, Sarah and I absolutely lost a lot of control over the bakery's merch. Every few minutes, one of us would be like, no, I can't justify buying this thing even though I really like it. Buy it, you'll statistically never come back here ever again. You're right. This was the perfect day. I woke up, was surrounded by Chikoa for 12 hours straight, and then went to sleep.
but I'm sure you want to see the damage. All right, you've been patient. Witness the spoils of our Chikoa adventures through Chikoa Park, the ramen shop, cafe, bakery, Tokyo Station, and store. I admit it looks pretty extreme, but I have an explanation that's not mental illness. Since I've dragged so many of my friends into the Chikoa rabbit hole alongside me, I wanted to get them all gifts to, in a way,